Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Base where people don't want to actually be able to in college if Sarita doesn't win. But we don't have any contextualization of what these black people in college and on the, you know, on the actual pro tour go through to actually be able to play. And I think that by us, you know, I've seen debates where people don't want to claim Osaka as black. They're like, she's not black, she's Haitian. You know, I just find that it's just a very limited view of the African diaspora, especially the ways in which her racialization has actually played out on tour, right? Because she does deal with racism in Asia. She does deal with racism in America. She looks like a black woman. It's very difficult to read her solely as a Japanese person, even not even a Japanese American. So I would caution black people to not fall into that trap of thinking that the only black people that exist, the only black people affected by white supremacy and racism are black people in America.
The U.S. Open, it gave my family plenty to talk about yesterday. Today, we here on the show are still talking about it. Naomi Osaka versus Serena Williams in the final. The score gave the win to Osaka, but the subplots in the match were distracting to say the least. A couple of controversial calls, including the chair umpire docking Williams a whole game after she called the umpire a thief. Here's Serena Williams afterwards.
I've seen other men call other umpires several things, and I'm here fighting for women's rights and for women's equality and for all kinds of stuff. And for me to say thief and for him to take a game, it made me feel like it was a sexist remark. I mean, like, how he's never took a game from a man because they said thief. For me, it blows my mind.
Arguably, if you watch the match, the mind that was most blown was Naomi Osaka's. She is the first person born in Japan to win a Grand Slam championship, but her victory is now tangled up in what is a larger conversation about tennis decorum, sexism, misogyny, and race. In Japan, though, Osaka's win is at the top of the news agenda, with a conversation about mixed race identity trailing not far behind. Motoko Rich is a reporter for the New York Times and joins us from Tokyo. So, first of all, what's been the reaction in Japan to Osaka's win? What have you heard?
Well, on the surface, it's been kind of overwhelming, you know, straightforward joy. There's a lot of pride. A lot of people said they thought it was impossible that a Japanese woman would win a Grand Slam so soon. They were completely taken by surprise. So there was the sort of media reaction is overjoyed. And when I was out on the streets on Sunday and I visited some tennis courts, people had all gotten up really early because it was like 5 a.m. here to watch the match. And they were really, really thrilled that she had won. But when you sort of take a step back and look at what this might mean for Japan, which has typically had a very conflicted relationship with its own notion of what it means to be Japanese, which the most conservative element is to think of being Japanese as kind of a pure-blooded ethnicity and race. And so she confounds that. I think she's very, very popular here. Whether or not she can actually help change attitudes more broadly about mixed race people, we'll have to see. But the sense that I got from talking to people on the street was that people are becoming more open-minded and think that old antiquated notions that you can only be one kind of person or to be Japanese, you have to be racially pure. I think people are starting to change those ways of thinking.
So I want to get to the decorum and misogyny critiques in a moment, but this is something that I have not heard a lot about. So some people who watched the match may have been surprised to see fans waving Japanese flags as well as Haitian flags, and that is Naomi Osaka's background. How does that create perceptions of her in Japan? What do people see?
Well, I think the critique outside of Japan of how she's perceived in Japan is that there's so much kind of national pride. The prime minister thanked her for inspiring and bringing all this energy to Japan at a time, and frankly, when it's been buffeted by natural disasters. But there's not a lot of talk of her Haitian background. Mm. And so I think the critique outside of the United States of the Japanese response is, hey, why are you taking all this credit for her and describing her as just Japanese? She's equally Haitian. I mean, it's complicated by the fact that she is, in fact, playing for Japan. And if she ends up going to the Olympics, the idea is that she would probably represent Japan. So I think there's a lot of different sort of threads that are kind of pulling at this notion. So even when I was talking to people and saying, so do you think of her as Japanese? Some people would pause and say, well, it's complicated. I mean, she has Japanese nationality, but her father's Haitian. She doesn't really speak Japanese very well. But then there was also this interesting effort that I found among a lot of people to try to sort of claim her as Japanese based on her personality and her traits. So people would say,
meaning
well,
what?
She seems very Japanese because she's very humble. And interestingly, in her response to the controversy, that she apologized for winning and that she sort of, when she thanks the crowd and Serena for being allowed to play, for the opportunity to play, and she bowed her head, I think from the Japanese perspective, they said, ah, she's one of us. She's very Japanese. And again, there's a sort of conflicted response to that from perhaps outside of Japan to look at that and say, wait a minute, aren't you underscoring, in embracing her, aren't you in fact underscoring stereotypes of what it means to be Japanese?
So is it people like Naomi Osaka who are changing the conversation and attitudes in Japan about mixed race people?
I think so. But I think, you know, one has to look at it with cautious optimism. I certainly talked to people who made the very valid point that the reason why she's being embraced is because she's a celebrity and because she's a winner, and that people who don't necessarily, who are, you know, quote unquote, normal people who are trying to live here in Japanese society might face more discrimination. So I think slowly things are changing.
So let's get to the decorum and misogyny, Motoko. A lot of the discussion here in the U.S. is centered on that. How is that conversation playing out in Japan?
You know, I don't think it's as big a conversation here. I hesitate to call it superficial, but it's a very kind of joyful celebration of the fact that she won. And there hasn't been as much discussion about what the sort of controversy, other than in a kind of, oh, isn't it unfortunate? Partly that may be because Japan is still way, way behind the United States in conversation about sexism. There hasn't been a Me Too movement here in the same way that there's been in the United States. There hasn't been a rise of feminism here, even as much as there's been in South Korea. So I think in some respects, part of that has to do with the social context here in Japan.
Motoko Rich with The New York Times speaking with us from Tokyo. Thanks very much, Motoko.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And the call on Serena Williams does remain controversial today. The International Tennis Federation, the governing body for all of tennis, sided with the chair umpire who made the calls against Williams. The U.S. Open also fined Williams $17,000. But the Women's Tennis Association, the governing body for women's tennis, is backing Williams' charge of sexism.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? White genetic annihilation. All these people from Syria coming up in here.
The Swedish general election has ended in what looks like a dead heat between the centre-right and the centre-left. Each bloc has about 40% of the vote, well short of a majority. As expected, the anti-immigrant Sweden Democrats made big gains and could now hold the balance of power. None of the established parties wants to work with them, but Sweden Democrat MEP Peter Lundgren says they may have to.
It's about taking responsibility to be able to sit down and make a coalition. They can no longer ignore us. They will have to let us in the discussions about how to form a new government in Sweden.
Our reporter Maddie Savage is following the latest developments in Stockholm.
We're still waiting for a couple more areas of Sweden to report their results. 5,901 out of 6,004 districts have come back, though. And as you say, it's pretty much neck and neck between the two very traditional blocs in Sweden, the centre-left and the centre-right, both on around 40%. But the party that everyone was talking about ahead of this election, the Sweden Democrats, the Nationalist Immigration Party, which didn't even enter parliament until 2010... How did they get on? Well, they were predicted to get up to 25% in some polls and become the second largest party in Sweden. Results suggest that's not the case. They're getting just below 18%, putting them into third place. But that's still a big jump since the last election in 2014, when they got just under 13% of the vote. And pictures from their celebration showing a very jubilant leader, Jimmy Åkesson, clearly pleased with how they've performed.
Yeah, and given that they hold that missing amount of votes, which would enable either the centre-right or centre-left to have a majority, will they be involved in coalition negotiations?
It's unclear at this stage. The leader, Jimmy Åkesson, has come out tonight and said he's very keen to work with the centre-right parties. The leader of the largest centre-right party, Ulf Kristersson, he's come out and said he thinks that the centre-left current Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, should resign. But really, we're in a bit of a waiting game. The centre-right parties have previously said that they won't work with the Sweden Democrats. Will that change? Will they have some kind of other role? We don't know at this point. Others are still saying there could be a new kind of combination where some of the smaller centre parties club together with the left and form a new kind of political constellation that we've never seen before. So we'll be watching and waiting to see what happens in the coming hours, days, possibly even weeks.
Maddie Savage in Stockholm.
And there was an ace. Grader, white male, using Photoshop. I'm a graphic designer, so he was using Photoshop for a project and making an image of a white man that I did not recognize. Have like glowy eyes. If you can envision the scene from Ghostbusters where the gentleman becomes possessed after he visits Sigourney Weaver's apartment, that's basically what he was doing to his eyes. So the picture stood out to me. It wasn't like abnormal, but it was peculiar. And I said, who is this guy? He said, oh, this is Leon DeGrell. I said, okay. And who is he? And he said, oh, he's the leader of the current leader of the Nazi party in Germany. I said, oh, okay. Well, what we're not going to do is make artwork or any other propaganda out of any Nazis or other white supremacists. And I'm going to report this. So you need to get that off the screen right away.
Here in the U.S., concerns over anti-immigrant sentiments and emboldened white supremacy groups have recently loomed large in the news and in our minds. And from our perspective, with a U.S. refugee program now slowed to its lowest levels in decades, Germany can seem radical in empathy and openness in its acceptance of over 1 million refugees. But Germany's immigration policies have also sparked an apparent backlash, a resurgence in neo-Nazi presence both in the public realm and in government. In recent weeks, thousands have taken to the streets in eastern Germany to protest the country's refugee policy, while many others have come out to express support for it. Here to discuss the recent brazen actions of the far right and neo-Nazis, as well as the vehement backlash against them, are Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times, Katrin Benhold, and reporter Yasmin Sirhan from The Atlantic. I'm very pleased that both of you were able to join us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yasmin, can we start with you? Explain to our listeners what the event was that sparked these most recent protests in Germany.
Sure. So the event that sparked the most recent protests, it all basically centered around the death of a German national who was identified as Daniel Hillig and who was allegedly killed by two immigrants believed to be from Iraq and Syria. His death, like other incidents of violence in Germany allegedly perpetrated by immigrants, sparked a huge backlash particularly in Chemnitz, where this man was from, thousands of protesters seized upon his death to basically turn out against German Chancellor Angela Merkel's 2015 decision not to close Germany's doors to asylum seekers as part of the European migrant crisis.
And you reported that one rally had about 8,000 people there with hundreds of identifiable neo-Nazis. How do we know that they are neo-Nazis? What makes them identifiable?
I mean, for starters, there were several individuals that were openly flashing Hitler salutes and shouting Nazi slogans. There were also identifiable on social media by belonging to various groups. So, you know, there's groups like the NS Boys, with an obvious symbolism to the NS, capital N, capital S, but really their name is the New Society Boys is what they call themselves. So they play around with language like that, but it's pretty obvious in what part of the political spectrum or, you know, activist spectrum they belong.
Right.
We saw a lot of hooligan groups, particularly in the East, that have developed links to the far-right scene that got involved, particularly on the first day after news of this death that Jasmine described of that German local man emerged. And very, very quickly, and that was one thing that really marks out Chemnitz as a sort of watershed in a way in terms of far-right mobilization, very, very quickly they mobilized and really overwhelmed police. So within hours, they managed to mobilize on that first Sunday at the end of August, already some 800 people. And there were many, many local citizens that simply joined what had been billed online as a kind of a march of condolence, of sort of mourning the victim. But the neo-Nazis pretty much hijacked it, and the violence on that first day was particularly stunning. That's when some of this video footage emerged showing what some have described as you know, houndings of foreigners, where sort of breakout groups of activists would run after dark-skinned people.
Wow.
Tomorrow is the 10-year anniversary of the Lehman Brothers crash. The Wall Street investment firm was one of the many players that sold bad home loans and led to the country's financial crisis. Minority families were especially affected, according to the state's Association of Realtors, and when the housing market collapsed, those families' dreams of home ownership collapsed around them as well. A decade later, some of them still haven't recovered, and the scars of foreclosure continue to take a toll on the many neighborhoods around Southern California. To take a look at that impact, we have Elena McCargo, Vice President of Housing Finance Policy at the Urban Institute. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start by talking about the benefits of homeownership and why it's significant that minorities have a lower homeownership rate.
The fact is that homeownership has provided the solid foundation for wealth building for many families in this country. For decades.
So what does it mean then for a family when they own a home?
Well, it means that they are connected in their community in a very unique way. The home ownership story, it has been a story for most Americans that has been the way in which, or a bedrock that they've used to build wealth in their families. It's not riches, but it's equity, and it's the ability over time to be able to use that equity to help your children go to college, or to put a down, or to help your children put a down payment on their home. White families have had that benefit for decades. It has been slower for minorities. Black and Hispanic families have much lower home ownership rates overall, and we see that present itself in lower wealth, less savings, and less economic mobility.
Now, before the financial crash in 2008, many minorities who bought homes in Southern California ended up in more affordable places, such as the Inland Empire around San Bernardino and Riverside. Elena, how enthusiastic were they to buy a house?
I'm sure they were very enthusiastic. Home ownership rate was on a very interesting increase across the board for all races from 2005, 2006 into 2007. And we saw minority families really elevating their homeownership rates during that period. They had been able to make this purchase, were going to establish their families in this community, and were setting themselves up for a situation where they would be part of a community and also build equity. While that's a good thing, what we also saw was home prices going into what we now call the bubble, being at the very highest levels. They were reaching their peak at that time. So essentially what happened is minority home buying peaked at the exact worst time.
I'm speaking with Elena McCargo, Vice President of Housing Finance Policy at the Urban Institute. Now, when the market then went bust, I mean, who was hurt the most and by how much?
In 2008 and 2009, when the bubble burst, the people that bought those homes, you know, in $400,000 and $500,000 at their peak, lost everything. In some cases, 50% of the equity in those homes. Those homes were not worth what they paid for them. They found themselves in a negative equity position.
Yeah.
And so that is a real, I think, fundamental point for the story is minority home buying, while it did see gains, it peaked at the exact worst time. And that is why the story for minorities has been so difficult in terms of recovery. And the damage that was done was so intensely deep for minority communities. And what we found is those very same individuals who did lose their homes are probably renting. During this period, rents started to skyrocket as well. They're probably finding themselves in a fairly significant, in a financially difficult spot. Yeah. Credit was blemished. You know, income may have been decreased. So all of these things just sort of compounding, I think, have been especially damaging for individuals and in minority individuals overall.
And then as we look back, we realize that the loans many minorities were offered were just plain bad. Why weren't more secure mortgages offered to those specific families?
I don't know that anyone has the answer for why, but what was happening is individuals were very focused on getting their piece of the dream, and predatory practices, bad lending products that really set people up for failure, and then the inability for the system to support those same consumers that were put into these loans after the crisis hit, really had a spiraling effect and really caused communities, entire neighborhoods, particularly in Southern California, to be sort of blighted, emptied, vacant homes, a really, truly tragic situation, as that area was one of the hardest hit.
Now, if in 2008 someone declared Chapter 13 bankruptcy, that was off their credit record a few years ago. If they declared Chapter 7, that should come off their record this year. Are there signs that minority families who were burned once before are trying to get back into the market now that maybe they look better on paper?
I think some are, and some, and that is happening for sure. I will tell you though, the homeownership rates are still incredibly depressed, particularly for minority families. You know, when you look at the white population, Asian population, it was a blip for them. Homeownership rates for whites has been in the 70% for 30 years, and really didn't see much of a dip. There have been declines in some areas, but it is just not as significant as what we saw in the African-American and Hispanic space. One other thing I want to mention, too, is we are seeing the Hispanic recovery do much better than the Black homeownership recovery. Some of that's just pure numbers of people, but there is just a lot of attention that we've paid here at the Urban Institute to looking at the Black homeownership gap, understanding how the Black mobility has been impacted, and more fundamentally, how Black wealth has been stripped away to a level that looks, that is on a trajectory that is incredibly, could be devastating.
Elena McCargo, Vice President of Housing Finance Policy at the Urban Institute. Elena, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Locking down the Constitution. It happened on the last Wednesday of August 2018. Around 8:30 p.m., the PA system announced a lockdown of the prison, apparently in response to a recent spate of staff sicknesses thought to be related to drugs. Even though the suspected cases occurred in prisons in the western part of Pennsylvania, the entire state system, almost 30 prisons, went into immediate lockdown. Lockdown means no movement in the prison except for staff. That means all prisoners are locked in their cells for 24 hours a day. All visits were canceled. Mail delivery and outgoing mail was canceled. Several days into this process, guards distributed a 3-page memo to prisoners announcing new rules allegedly designed to defeat drug smuggling. Among them, prisons will no longer receive mail, for all correspondence will be rerouted through an address in St. Petersburg, Florida. That office will scan and copy the mail and then send a digital copy back to Pennsylvania. Legal mail will be Xeroxed and a copy given to the prisoner named in the mail. For 3 months, no visitor can purchase food or photos for a prisoner, and no books can be ordered by a prisoner. The DOC, it appears, is having a temper tantrum, and it is engaged in war against all contact with the public. This sounds like the DOC's equivalent of reefer madness. This is, more than anything else, Pennsylvania's DOC's engagement in drug politics. It's a war against the prisoners, yes, but also a war against knowledge and ultimately the Constitution itself. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We start today with a look at violence in our schools, but we're not talking about student gun violence. We're shifting our focus to stun guns and the school police who use them. You might know them as tasers, a common brand of the weapon. Last year, 15-year-old Jalijah Jones was a freshman in high school in Kalamazoo, Michigan, when he had an unexpected and violent run-in with an armed school police officer.
He got in a small fight with another student. It was over a small amount of money. There was pushing and shoving and some punches thrown, but no one actually got hurt. It was quickly broken up, and one of the students walked away. Jalijah had a harder time calming down. He was kind of huffing and puffing around the hallway, but school security came and they seemed to have it under control. They restrained him. At some point, though, a school police officer came by. And while school security guards were dealing with him, the school police officer took him and tasered him.
Tasered him at his school after a minor altercation.
Jalijah fell to the ground. He lost control of his body. The school police officer handcuffed him and ended up dragging him through the hallway. There's actually some video of it. His body is completely limp. He ended up getting arrested for disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, and he's still fighting those charges today. And he spent many hours in the hospital. He has some scars from the incident.
I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. And it turns out what happened to Jalijah has happened to students at U.S. public schools across the country. So what gives? Rebecca Klein is the education reporter for HuffPost you just heard from, and she's been looking into how often students are getting stunned by their own school safety officers.
So the problem is we really don't know. There is no local, state, or federal agency keeping track of this number. So we set out a few years ago to create our own count. Because this isn't being systemically tracked in any way, the only way for us to get this information was to look through old local news reports over the years. So we've been tracking local news reports since 2011 to try and get a very bare minimum count to see at least how often this is reported. And we found that since September 2011, students have been tasered or shot with a stun gun by school police officers at least 120 times.
And that's 120 instances across the country?
Yeah, across the country.
Now, I'm just curious, why don't schools keep track of these incidences? You would think that this is something serious enough to warrant some sort of record. Is that not right?
Yeah. So the complication is the police officers who are based in schools are actually employed by local police departments. So they don't necessarily answer to a school administrator or a school principal. They answer to local police departments, and local police departments don't keep this data I don't know what their overall use of force data looks like, but they certainly do not keep it specific to children in schools.
What does a taser actually do to a body in general? And then how does it impact a child's body?
In the worst case scenario, tasers can cause cardiac arrest. And actually, on the warning label of the taser weapon, it warns against using the weapon on low body mass index in children. And obviously, if you're working in a school, many of the students there are going to be small children. And it's more likely that children will suffer from cardiac arrest from these weapons. And then beyond that, there has been a case in the past where when you are tasered, your body becomes debilitated and you might fall to the ground. You're incapacitated. And so there was a child a few years ago who was tasered and in the midst of falling to the very harsh ground of the hallway, ended up having to get into a coma because he was so severely brain damaged from how hard he hit his head.
Now, obviously, we don't want to minimize anyone's pain, but I'm thinking 120 cases across the United States is a pretty small number. Wouldn't you agree?
It's a small number, but it is the very bare minimum. As we know, there are not a tremendous amount of local news outlets anymore, and this might not be the priority topic for their coverage. And oftentimes, there's no reason why a local news outlet would gain whiff of it. So we're under the impression that this is probably happening a lot more than we know about. 30% of school police officers, according to government data, carry these weapons. So again, this is very much a minimum count.
You said 30%. So not all school resource officers are carrying these. Why are they carrying them? Who makes that decision? Is it the local police department? Is it usually in response to something that's happened at a school? For example, do police departments say, you know, this school has been under threat or has experienced something like a mass shooting, let's give our police officers tasers?
Most of the time, school police officers, if they carry a taser when they're on the streets dealing with adults, then they would wear the exact same weapons into the school. They don't normally remove tools from their arsenal when they enter a school. So in most cases, it is under the purview of the local police department. Sometimes school boards will intervene and have a specific say over what weapons are carried. But from what I understand, it really depends on a case-by-case basis, depending on the locality.
Well, and one of the things that we know, I mean, I've reported on this, and I'm sure lots of folks have been looking at this, is that schools increasingly across the United States are using and relying more on police departments and police officers as these school resource officers to sort of manage their security and other issues. But this seems to be a bit beyond that. This looks like it's really talking about school discipline and who's being disciplined and who isn't. Are you noticing any racial or gender patterns or distinctions in the research that you have? Are there certain populations that are disproportionately affected by tasing versus others?
So it's hard to draw those conclusions from the data we have because it is so incomplete at this point. But research does show that Black children are disproportionately suspended, expelled, and also they are disproportionately getting criminal referrals from these police officers who are based in schools, even for low-level offenses. So we think it's probably fair to assume that they are also bearing the brunt of use of these weapons.
We're talking about tasers used by police against kids in school. Rebecca Klein of HuffPost has been tracking instances of school officers using tasers against students. I can only imagine if a parent finds out that their child has been tasered, what the response would be. But you, what are the parents saying that you've spoken to?
Many of the parents that I've spoken to are supportive of the idea of having police officers in schools, especially amid the spate of deadly school shootings that we've seen, but had no idea that these weapons could be used on students for normal teenage or adolescent misbehavior. So while they might feel more comfortable with the idea of high secure environments in their child's schools, they're very deeply uncomfortable with the idea that these police officers could turn against their own students who aren't armed intruders, who are just going about their daily lives. And in many cases, I found that they are shocked that this is possible.
Rebecca, whatever happened to detention? I mean, I feel like we've gone, and I mean that in all seriousness, I feel like we've gone from minor infractions that are relatively normal. And I'm not talking about school shootings. I'm talking about, you know, graffiti here and there, or getting into a scuffle with a classmate, or not, you know, being attentive in class and just not being tased, but being put in detention. I mean, are we, have we passed that level in the United States? Are we past that anymore?
I think that's a very good question. What you have to remember is that when you have police officers in schools, these police officers are most likely going to treat children the same way that they treat any civilian engaging in some sort of misbehavior. So, for example, if an adult was on the street vandalizing a piece of property, that would result in a serious punishment. But in schools, we know it may not be uncommon for a young child to be vandalizing a desk in some way, or engaging in something they probably shouldn't be doing, but isn't that big of a deal in the scheme of things. And that now might result in them also getting referred to law enforcement, which could be very problematic for their future.
I'm also wondering about any training for law enforcement here. I mean, you mentioned an autistic child who had been tasered and, you know, for having an outburst in class, and knowing the little I know about children on the spectrum, I mean, those are sort of normal behaviors. And if police are not trained to deal with children in this very specific population, I can't imagine this going very well in the future. Is there any talk of policy implementation or training on how and when to implement this type of technology?
So typically this is completely decided on a locality by locality basis. There are trainings that exist, but these trainings cost money and they're expensive. So if a district or a department doesn't have extra funds, then they're not going to get it. And that's just something that's going to fall by the wayside.
I'm sorry. I'm just sort of stunned about that answer. What about schools? We talked about parents. We talked about police. What are schools saying about this? The schools that you're talking to, are they saying this is a critical part of their security protocols going forward?
Yeah. So how a school interacts with the police officers that they house really depends. Some school districts take in these officers and they don't really have any specific rules for how these officers are supposed to be interacting with students. Some schools are much more vigilant about it and they have a strict contract with the police officers and the police department saying what exactly these police officers are there to do and how they should be engaging with students. But again, it really depends. And most of the time, school districts are just allowing the police officers to come in and treat the children as they would treat people in their local police officer jobs.
I want to be a cop. Can you keep your lips sealed? I think with leadership skills can turn low-level offenders into crisp bills. You know, I've always wanted to be a cop.
In Chicago this week, jury selection continues in the murder trial of police officer Jason Van Dyke. Dash cam video of the 2014 shooting of black teenager Laquan McDonald sparked huge protest, forced firings and resignations. It also prompted a federal investigation. From member station WBEZ, Patrick Smith reports on how prosecutors will allege that the Chicago police worked together to hide the truth.
In October of 2014, Jason Van Dyke, a white Chicago police officer, shot Laquan McDonald, a black teenager, 16 times. The shooting exposed some dark truths about this city, including what many say is a history of covering up police shootings. This shooting also helped define the legacy of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who the day before jury selection began announced he was not running for re-election. But on that October night, 4 years ago, Laquan McDonald's death seemed like just another police shooting in a city that averaged almost one per week.
5142 on 42nd Pulaski.
You can hear the routine in the minutes after the gunfire, when an officer corrects a dispatcher asking about McDonald.
When you can, I need to get some info on the victim condition, whatever you can, when you can, okay?
Offender.
That's what I meant.
It's agreed. The person shot is the offender, not the victim. Now, in the 7 years leading up to McDonald's death, Chicago officers had shot nearly 400 people, and the city had not found a single one of these shootings to be unjustified. The city had become efficient at moving past these incidents. So when Van Dyke shot McDonald, the officers on the scene likely had little reason to think there would be repercussions. Prosecutors say it appears they came together behind a story about the shooting. A man named Pat Camden arrived to tell it to the public.
The officers are responding to somebody with a knife in a crazed condition who stabs out tires on a vehicle and tires on a squad car you obviously aren't going to sit down and have a cup of coffee with them.
Camden is not a public official. He's with the union that represents cops when they face discipline. That night, he tells Chicago's ABC7 that McDonald was coming at officers with the knife.
He is a very serious threat to the officers, and he leaves them no choice at that point but to defend themselves.
Officers on the scene put that version down on paper. And normally in Chicago, that's where the story ends. But this time, there was a video, and it's sure to be a key part of the murder trial. The reports of Jason Van Dyke claim McDonald was swinging the knife in his hand aggressively and that he'd battered three officers with it. Prosecutors will say the dash cam video of the shooting doesn't show those things. The reports say Officer Van Dyke backpedaled. Prosecutors will say the video only shows him stepping toward McDonald. And the reports say once Van Dyke had shot him to the pavement, McDonald kept trying to get up, still pointing the knife at him. But prosecutors will likely play the video showing McDonald crumpled on his side, taking one bullet after another. Reports from other officers on the scene backed up Van Dyke's version of the shooting. In fact, three officers are charged with conspiring to cover up the truth of the shooting and are due to go on trial this fall. Their defenders say the dashcam video gives an incomplete picture of what happened, that it doesn't show the perspective of each officer, and that high levels of stress could have distorted the officers' perceptions. But former Chicago police officer Shannon Spaulding embraces a different explanation.
The code of silence was instantly put into full effect. You are conditioned to never, ever go against another officer.
Spaulding spoke out about misconduct by her fellow officers. She went undercover in 2008 in a separate case to get evidence that eventually convicted two officers on federal charges. She says she knows what those officers on the scene of the McDonald's shooting were feeling.
They were deer in headlights. My gosh, someone was just killed. When you have someone like the street deputy or lieutenant handing you a piece of paper and says, this is what your report is going to say, that becomes the truth.
That official narrative held up for more than a year, until late 2015, when a judge ordered the city to release the dash cam video of the shooting.
The actions in the video will be debated and discussed in the days ahead.
Mayor Rahm Emanuel appealed for a calm response.
But we as a city of Chicago, all of us also have to make an important judgment about ourselves and our city as we go forward.
But when the video came out, Chicago erupted in protest. The police superintendent was fired. The Justice Department came in to investigate. And for the first time in more than 30 years, a Chicago police officer was charged with first-degree murder for an on-duty shooting. Van Dyke's attorney, Dan Herbert, says the video itself doesn't show the whole truth of what happened.
People will judge the split-second actions of my client. What was my client experiencing at the time in which he made this split-second decision to fire?
And Van Dyke himself says the night he killed McDonald was the first time he'd ever shot his gun while on duty.
I never would have fired my gun if I didn't think my life was in jeopardy. It's something you have to live with forever.
One question, whether Jason Van Dyke had to shoot Laquan McDonald that night, could soon be in a jury's hands. For NPR News, I'm Patrick Smith in Chicago.
And member station WBEZ is covering the shooting, fallout, and trial of Officer Jason Van Dyke in a podcast called 16 Shots.
See, it used to be we could beat up minorities and nobody cared. It's the reason a lot of us joined the force. Hey, Mitch, you want to go down and arrest some homeless people but not be able to beat up any minorities? No, thank you. Yeah, no, I think we're good.
Chief revealed officers were disciplined over a controversial altercation with NBA player Sterling Brown. Newly released body cam video shows the incident in January that started with a parking violation. Officers can be seen subduing Brown and using a stun gun on him. The video appears to contradict an initial police account that reportedly said Brown was uncooperative. DeMarco Morgan is outside Milwaukee Police Headquarters. DeMarco, good morning.
Nora, good morning to you. This is not the first time the Milwaukee Police Department has been the focus of questionable use of force. Sterling Brown now says he plans to file a lawsuit sometime next week to hopefully prevent something like this from happening again in the near future.
Our department conducted an investigation into the incident, which revealed members acted inappropriately and those members were recently disciplined.
On Wednesday, newly appointed Milwaukee Police Chief Alfonso Morales apologized for his officers' actions and the January incident. It started as what police described as a routine check around 2 a.m.
I just told you to back up.
A police officer had spotted NBA player Sterling Brown's vehicle parked across two handicapped lanes at a Walgreens parking lot.
I got up in your face.
Right.
Really.
At first, Brown can be seen calmly talking to police. But once backup arrives, the situation intensifies. Brown is thrown to the ground.
Taser, taser, taser!
Hit with a taser and arrested. He was briefly booked in jail but released a short time later. No charges were filed. Hours after the incident, the Milwaukee Bucks rookie played in an NBA game with bruises on his face. After the game, he refused to comment on what happened.
No, it's being handled.
The case has placed added pressure on a department already under scrutiny. In 2016, riots broke out after an officer shot and killed Seville Smith after a traffic stop. Smith had a gun, but in a split-second decision, an officer shot and killed him after Smith apparently tossed his weapon aside. As last year, the city settled a lawsuit for $2.3 million for the 2014 killing of Dontre Hamilton, a mentally ill man who was agitated by an officer's unlawful pat-down. The officer shot Hamilton 14 times during their altercation.
Milwaukee Bucks have issued a statement which reads...
Now, Brown released a statement yesterday saying, and I quote, what should have been a simple parking ticket turned into an attempt at police intimidation, followed by the unlawful use of physical force. As for the officers involved, the police chief has not said how they were disciplined.
Well, finally, a cop. You'll be indicted for showing PDA in a PDF and a PB&J soap on the TV set chemically discourages your graffiti sketch. I'm a cop.
After 6 years on the force, we have learned a former Metro cop who resigned over drug charges can no longer work in law enforcement again in Tennessee. Alan Frio is at the precinct where Matthew Bite was assigned. So, Alan, does this end the investigation officially?
Well, since Matthew Bite resigned, yes, it ends the investigation. But you have to keep this in mind. He's going to have to find a new line of work. He was decertified as a cop here in Tennessee.
From growing magic mushrooms used to get a high to texting the N-word in a message to a friend. A witness backed up the charges with video and texts. Metro PD has been looking into the charges since January. The evidence Metro had was damning, particularly video of Matthew Bite's magic mushroom growing operation. However, rather than face Metro investigators, Matthew Bite handed in his resignation on June 19th. Bite is a six-year veteran of the department. The investigation may be over, but the impact is not. His career in law enforcement is effectively over.
Now, Metro PD says using the N-word in that text is reprehensible and will not be tolerated by the department.
North Carolina.
Activists and students who support the toppling of the Confederate Silent Sam statue at UNC Chapel Hill say they've been abused and assaulted by police. Pepper spray was used at one of the last demonstrations to disperse a crowd. Race and Southern Culture reporter Leonita Inge says the Chapel Hill Community Policing Advisory Committee got an earful.
One after the other, people who have been protesting against the Silent Sam statue at McCorkle Place walked to the front of the room, listing incidents of when police allegedly harmed them during a recent protest. Maya Little is a UNC graduate student in history who was charged earlier this year with defacing Silent Sam.
Again, this officer directly pepper sprayed me and a number of other people for no reason whatsoever besides to escort and help escort the white supremacists on our campus out.
UNC graduate student Sammy Siddiqui told the committee he believes certain students were targeted by police just to arrest them.
The police are there to be attack dogs of people in power. That is not going to change overnight, and that is not something you can do. What we can ask you to do is to stop having the Chapel Hill police be complicit in what is happening.
At least two of the speakers said, with the escalating tension at Silent Sam rallies, they fear someone would be seriously hurt or killed. The Community Policing Advisory Committee usually meets monthly at the Chapel Hill Police Department, but moved the gathering to the public library because of an expected overflow crowd. Chapel Hill Police Chief Chris Blue came to the meeting prepared to speak, but attendees asked that police not be present when they presented their complaints. Blue spoke with me outside.
Anybody in this community related to the Silent Sam events or otherwise who thinks a Chapel Hill police officer has behaved in a way that doesn't meet our community expectations, they need to tell me that.
More than two dozen people have been arrested since the toppling of Silent Sam last month. Chapel Hill officials say all arrests were made by UNC police. Leonida Inge, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
We turn now to Texas and a recent instance of police violence, not against a student, but against a civilian in his own home. 26-year-old Botham Shinjan was shot and killed inside his Dallas apartment by off-duty police officer Amber Geiger. Geiger told authorities she thought she had walked into her own apartment and that she mistook Jean for an intruder. Geiger was arrested on manslaughter charges on Sunday, but the incident is prompting a hard look at violence perpetrated by police officers who are off the clock. Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, and he's also a former cop. And he's one of the few people collecting data on this underreported trend of off-duty police crime.
When we look at the numbers, about 900 non-federal sworn law enforcement officers, so that would be state troopers, police officers, deputy sheriffs, about 900 a year are arrested, and I have data going back to about 2005 in my database. So about 900 a year. And when we look at those 900 officers who are arrested annually, about 60% of them are arrested for crimes that occur while an officer is off duty.
The case that we're looking at is obviously pretty unique, I would imagine. I think some of the things that are surprising here are that at least what we're starting to see is one of the reasons that's being given is that she was working. The officer had worked a very long shift, could have led to some sort of that situational lack of awareness. Do you find that officers who are just overtired are committing these crimes?
You know, it's difficult from the data that I'm able to collect and analyze, but I can tell you anecdotally, and I can tell you from other research that's been done, is that stress, shift work, post-traumatic stress syndrome, these are all factors that come into play with officers who are making the wrong decisions on use of force incidents, both on duty and off duty. So I don't think we can discount that as a possibility. But, you know, with these types of crimes, there are things that we otherwise can't discount. We can't take race out of the equation. Anytime you're dealing with things in the criminal justice system, you have to look at race-related issues. And then one of the concerns that I've had for many years now has to do with officers and off-duty firearms. So police officers in most jurisdictions across the country are encouraged, if not required, to carry their service weapons with them when they're in public while off duty. And what I've seen is that hundreds of times over the last decade, we've seen officers involved in off-duty incidents that can't be described in any other way as bizarre violence. You just can't explain the facts, using firearms in ways that rational people would not use a firearm.
The encouragement to carry a weapon when you're off duty, where does that come from?
There's actually a federal law that allows off-duty police officers to carry their firearms across state lines without any sort of registration of their firearms to carry off-duty in other states. So it's a big issue, and I think we have to look at the police subculture and the way that police officers are socialized. And I know from my own background, I was a police officer for several years a long time ago, that police officers are socialized into an us versus them mentality. And quite literally, anyone who's not a law enforcement officer in this type of situation is perceived as a threat, as a potential enemy. I think the police socialization process and the police subculture is an integral component of helping us to understand what happened here.
Are there any data that show differences in gender? This was obviously a white woman police officer. We've seen other instances where women police officers have been involved in shootings, specifically of Black Americans. Does your data show any gender breakdown?
Well, only about 5% of the cases in my database. So we have about 15,000 cases in my database of officers who were arrested over the last 14 years, and that's about 12 or 13,000 officers. The reason for the difference in the numbers there is that some officers have more than one arrest case during our study years for a variety of reasons. So only about 5% of those cases are female officers. When we look at those cases and try to do statistical analyses, we actually see that the police women, the female officers, are just as violent as the male officers in terms of the types of crimes they're getting involved in. And that extends to officer-involved domestic violence and other off-duty crimes as well.
And I'm also wondering if you're noticing any patterns in terms of the victims of these crimes. You mentioned race earlier in this conversation and the impact that that has on policing. It's no surprise. We've continued to see instances where white officers kill and shoot indiscriminately and indiscriminately kill Black Americans who are unarmed. Is this a pattern that you see in the data as well?
You know, for many years, we did not collect data on the race of the officers or the race of the victims in these cases. I just didn't think that it was something we'd be able to figure out very easily from the data we had. And about 7 or 8 years ago, one of my graduate research assistants came to me and said, you know, I think we really need to track the race of the officers here, race and ethnicity. So we started to do that with a great deal of success. And what we're finding is we can figure out the race and ethnicity of the victims in about 20 to 25% of the arrest cases. But we have so many cases in our database, within the next 6 months to a year, we're going to start to have enough that we'll be able to do statistical analyses and directly answer your questions about the impact of race and ethnicity in these police crime cases involving violence.
And you also said you've been an officer yourself. When you talk to police officers, are there concerns about these types of incidences, off-duty, carrying their weapon? Do they want to do this when they're off-duty? I knew one police officer who actually felt that he should not carry his weapon off while he was off-duty and would keep it at home. What's the sense just on a personal level from the officers that you know?
Well, it varies, but I would say that, you know, 8 out of 10 officers seem to have a very close relationship with their gun and badge, and they view it as something that they wouldn't leave home without. And I realize when I come out and say things like, well, I think it's time that we reconsider whether off-duty officers should always be carrying guns, it's something that law enforcement officers, many of them, are not happy with when I say that. But when I say that, I'm also thinking of the fact that when we look at the fact that about 60% of the crimes for which officers are arrested that are off-duty are violent-related crimes. And of those violent-related off-duty crimes, about 42% of them are alcohol-related. In other words, the officer was intoxicated at the time of the crime. It's very troubling. You know, we just need to look a lot more into it. And I think we need to keep talking about it. We need to go back to these policy issues and readdress it and continue the discussion going.
Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Phil, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's the nation's capital. It's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital. Washington, D.C. It's the capital. Got you feeling capital. The punishment is capital. In Washington.
By now, the flooding and other damage from extreme weather is something you've heard about. Now, here's a crisis you may not have heard much about. Overdoses believed to have been caused by the use of synthetic marijuana. Here in Washington, D.C., officials say medics evaluated 118 people between Wednesday and midday Friday for suspected overdoses and transported nearly 100 of them to the hospital. And according to the Washington Post, officials are looking into 5 deaths that they think may be related to the overdoses. In July, more than 300 people overdosed in Washington, D.C. in a 3-week period. But this isn't a problem limited to Washington, D.C. In New Haven, Connecticut, last month, 70 people overdosed. We're joined now by Washington, D.C.'s Fire and EMS Chief Gregory Dean to tell us more about this. Chief, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Can you tell us any more about this recent spate of overdoses?
Well, we can't tell you the why. We can tell you what we're doing here in the district to address it. So the mayor has asked us to bring all the partners together. So we have fire department, we have law enforcement, we have health and human services, we have the medical director, we also have our department of forensics. Everybody has a part in this, health and our behavior people. So the fire department is responding and we're providing service to the patients.
I'm going to stick a little bit more with the why, if you don't mind, because these all happen within blocks of one another. In fact, right near our offices here. Any idea why that might be?
So I don't know that I can answer the why. You know, we are putting resources over there trying to see if we can deal with it, such as police is there looking in the areas that we've seen a constant flow of patients. Health and Human Services is there providing services, making sure they have water. Behavioral Health is over there offering assistance. So, again, I think if you look all around the country, if we can answer the why, I think we could all get there. So it really is, what are we doing to address the problem as it's here? And that is trying to get all these resources out there to assist people that are taking a drug that can cause death.
Can you just tell me, though, is there something in the nature of this particular drug itself that's leading to these terrible health effects? Is it tainted with something? Is there some contamination involved here? From what you know so far, I understand it's early days.
Yeah. Well, from what we know, even coming out of this summer, is that it's synthetic drugs that are mixed with unknown substance. So, you know, we're used to going to the store, buying something that has met all the requirements. These drugs are not required to meet any requirements, and in turn, people do not know what they're taking. So that's why the Department of Forensics is involved, because they're going through and trying to do the makeup of these type drugs that may help us in the future.
Before we let you go, what are you most concerned about right now?
Concerned about the health and welfare of our citizens. And that is why we are bringing all these resources together. And the mayor has asked that we look very closely at trying to keep our citizens safe. And we need help from our residents. If you see them in trouble, please call 911 so that we are able to provide the care that they need.
That is Washington, D.C.'s Fire and EMS Chief Gregory Dean. Chief, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
North Carolina.
Officials at American Red Cross shelters set up to house people during Hurricane Florence are still busy registering local residents and those who evacuated from coastal areas. More than 360 people registered at the various area shelters by Thursday night, 55 at East Mecklenburg High School. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn went there today and filed this report.
The East Mecklenburg High Shelter is one of 12 that the Red Cross is operating in the region. People of all ages are here from Wilmington, Rocky Mount, and other areas threatened by Hurricane Florence. The school's gym has rows of beds lined up with blankets and other supplies. Red Cross spokesperson Jerry Jameson says they can accommodate 150 people at this site. Registrations are ongoing, and pink wristbands have to be worn by those staying at the shelter. Jameson says the first question they ask people is if they have any special health needs.
We have nurses with the Department of Public Health who are here staffing it 24/7. So if they do have any medical needs or if they maybe didn't bring enough medication, we have nurses who can assist with that, eyeglasses and things like that.
Shelter officials provide people with snacks and beverages around the clock, and 3 meals are served. They also have a separate kennel area for people who come with pets. People are free to come and go, but they have to sign in and out. In front of the gym, several people are outside smoking or just walking around. Leaning against the building, Jimmy Ross says he drove to Charlotte from Monroe.
We live in a trailer, and I was involved in Hugo in 89, and I don't trust some hurricanes.
And who else is with you?
I have two younger brothers, Brian and Timothy Ross, and a friend of mine, Ben Gibson.
Gibson says he came because he could not find a place to wait the storm out in Monroe.
They didn't have no shelters down there. People get into you. So I come up here. Tell you the truth, I was homeless. I was living in a tent.
Around the corner of the building, Brenda Drakeford and Denise Cook, both former nurses, just met and seemed to be fast friends. Cook, an amputee, drove from Jacksonville and had no idea where she would stay when she arrived on Wednesday.
My son, thank God, somehow found this place and told us, get here right away. We came here. We were the only ones here. It was just me, my daughter, and my mom, and our dog, and our cats. And they opened up their arms and said, come on in. It was wonderful.
Drakeford nods in agreement. She lives in an apartment by herself in Charlotte and came to the shelter because of health concerns.
The police took me here. I have numerous health issues, and I live by myself, so I didn't have anybody, you know, in case something went, if I would have fell, or I had a heart attack last year. I have that in a pacemaker in, and I'm considered physically disabled.
With the police parked outside the shelter 24/7, Drakeford and Cook say they feel safe and have slept well here. With the uncertainty of the storm, some people admit to being a bit anxious, but like Drakeford and Cook, they are forming new bonds and exuding a sense of resiliency as they wait out the storm. For WFAE News, I'm Gwendolyn Glenn.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 15th, 2018. So I have been told. Again, I was born in Virginia. We have a substantial number of CAOS listeners and just victims of white supremacy, period, in the area that has been impacted by the hurricane. I hope CAOS listeners, victims of racism, took all precautions and, you know, did what they needed to make sure that they are in as safe a position as they can be in while all of this is taking place. I think all of us, to the best of our ability, if we can minimize having to be dependent on race soldiers in these type of situations, to the best of our ability, because, wow, it can really be. And we've had direct victims come in and give a lot of testimony. We had a lot of coverage of Hurricane Katrina and even some even some of the events that happened with Superstorm Sandy. Take these type of events seriously. If anything, they should be grim reminders of why we should be very serious with regards to working to solve this problem and with the way that we use time and energy. Last year, I forgot with Hurricane Maria and what happened with folks. We have listeners in the Houston area that are still dealing with that as well. Just the importance of being serious. That's the system of racism, white supremacy is set up to create problems for non-white people. Even if you have events like this, racists will take advantage and see what we can do to use the storm to help cause black people problems and mistreat them some more, terrorize them a lot more. So use these events as reminders. We should be very serious. War is being waged against us. All areas of people activity, our time and energy is vital. That should be reflected in our conduct at all times. That said, this is the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, observations. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Before we get to some of the folks who dialed in with commentary, I said there had been an issue with the iTunes uploading, getting the archives for like the last five, six programs. And until that problem is, or I will announce when that problem has been resolved, I suspect racist because it's been intermittent where this has been happening throughout the last year or so. At any rate, we are not exclusively archived at iTunes. The content is archived at Black Talk Radio Network. It's archived at SoundCloud. It is archived at YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox. Much obliged. Time and energy uploading the content to YouTube. That's just three locations. Google Play, I forgot about that. The most recent program, so like yesterday's broadcast, third installment of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, is on all of those platforms. SoundCloud, Black Talk Radio Network, YouTube. The most recent workplace racism broadcast, Dr. Tommy Curry, is on all of those platforms. He was here on Wednesday. So the most recent programs, I think some folks saw that iTunes hadn't updated and thought that, you know, I don't know, Gus was victim of another flood or something else had happened. Nope, we are broadcasting. Racists are just disrupting the iTunes feed, I think. But we are broadcasting and the archives are available. Next, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You will see the PayPal button. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested nearly a decade of broadcasting. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also hit the wish list, Amazon.com. It's under Gus T. Renegade. It is linked on my blog. You'll see it right beneath the PayPal button. Again, enormous gratitude to all of the investors who have nabbed items from my wish list. Much obliged. Again, I hope the program is providing constructive, accurate information on what white supremacy racism is, how it works. Incidentally, as the segments were concluding, and that last report, they were talking to some of the victims of the hurricane, how they were responding down in Mecklenburg County in North Carolina. I said, wow, white supremacy racism, that shapes my sense of geography on the planet. I said, Mecklenburg County, that's where race soldiers killed Jonathan Farrell back in 2013. Remember that? He had the car accident and he had the audacity to knock on a house to ask for help after having a car accident, and the race soldier showed up and killed him. It happened even yesterday within the last 24 hours. I was watching something and they said, oh man, we're going to Jasper. And I said, oh, that's where they killed James Byrd Jr. Dragged him behind the truck. Remember that one? That was 1998, Jasper, Texas. My whole sense of geography when they move around, it's just, you know, different victims who've been terrorized and pummeled, savaged by whites. Continuing, the reason that I played that segment, I made an error. I did want to play that segment, but there was an additional piece on the hurricanes that I wanted to play. I played that segment. One of the reasons was because they made such a point of emphasis about the dogs. I am not a pet lover. Anyone out there, if you know, have a creature in your domicile that, you know, is your homie, your friend, grand. But Gusty is not a pet person. But in the midst of this storm, oh, yeah, Fluffy is right here with us. You heard the white woman. She said, she sounded like she was a white woman to me. Said, you know, got the dog right here with us. And they were talking about different animals throughout the segment. That just, I get repulsed every time I hear that. I remember that with Hurricane Katrina. Whites published like books. There's, you know, like a whole section of literature that just focuses on the time and energy that whites invested in 2005 to rescue animals down in Louisiana and Mississippi. This is at the same time that whites were coming in not with water or luggage or rescue supplies, but were coming in with guns to hunt and kill black people. A.C. Thompson, ProPublica, guest on the program, 2009. That's what I mean. Like, I just get repulsed hearing, oh my gosh, we got to take 5 minutes to acknowledge that we also were able to rescue about 15 cats, that you have greater regard for the cats and dogs and squirrels than black people. Anyway, the segment that I made an error about was I was going to contrast it with the animals and how much attention they put there. And then they came back and they said, we had a number in South Carolina, we had a number of prisons that were in the line of the evacuation where they had told people like, hey, we think this storm is going to be a 500 to a 1000 year event. You know, you got to leave. But they didn't evacuate the prisons, and they made all these ridiculous excuses on saying, well, oh, we didn't know where to take them. And, you know, we didn't have proper buses and supervision, and we didn't want to be stuck out on the highway with these, you know, vagabonds and rapists out in the middle of all kinds of. Now, again, they just bragged about we went in and we got Fluffy and, you know, little Tigger, the Cocker Spaniel. They just bragged about that. They did that with 2005 as well. But people that have been locked up, enslaved, greater confinement. Oh, yeah, we don't. Just don't think we're going to have the resources to get you. Hope it works out for you. We'll be back after the storm is over. And that's the exact same thing they did in Hurricane Katrina. Remember how we talked? That's why I said we did signature work on that. We talked about how they left some of the inmates. They left them in the prison. They talked about how it was flooding and terrible conditions. They had some of them stacked on the side of the road. They did a whole documentary about that. Repeat behavior from whites. Anyway, maybe I'll include that in the archived section because I did think that was really important and I totally intended to play that and just made an error. I am a victim. The officer shootings, I've said pretty consistently over the years that that is like not my area of focus. In fact, I really don't make an I make an effort not to watch this footage going all the way back to Jonathan Farrell. I think that was probably one of the last pieces of video footage that I watched. I don't watch this footage. I've said pretty consistently for years, these events are going to happen. You just try the best you can to minimize it being you. I don't think stomping up and down in the street or pretending that this is the first time that these sort of things have happened. I don't think that that's healthy. It's going to happen. It doesn't mean to ignore the events. It doesn't mean to ignore the victims, but I just don't see the constructive value of placing a lot of time and energy into every one of these events. That said, there were a lot of them this week that, you know, took up a lot of time and energy, whether it's the trial situation that's happening in Chicago, the latest shooting that happened down in Dallas. I did think the segment on the officers in the school was important and them tasing children. If you ever needed, I talked at the beginning about just having reminders, the storm as a reminder about we should be serious. Dr. Welsing talked about that regularly, how we use our time and energy. Folks ever needed a reminder about, hey, before we get to the bedroom, let's be serious. Those 200 questions, one of them, what is our education child? What is our education plan going to be for our child for the first 10 years of this boy, girl's existence? Let's have that conversation before we get to the bedroom. Like, that is outstanding counter-racism, because if not, hey, no problem. The grandsister, she said, when you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. And I don't think anything is funny about ending up in a public school and being tased. Proceeding. This program, if we could not use metaphors, that would be super appreciated. That this is the only broadcast, the only particular segment where I make this request. If we could not use metaphors, racists, that is one of the really deceptive ways that they practice racism. They will frequently invoke comparisons, analogies where they contrast two separate entities, and they will insist these are equivalent, identical, same thing. And most or frequently, they are not. This is one of the ways, as I said, master deceivers. Victims like Gus T, we've been exposed to this behavior for a long time, and we are still learning. As such, sometimes we do not have, we have not come to a conclusion, and we don't have all of the logic that we need on a particular subject. So sometimes we'll substitute a metaphor, and often that just creates a lot more confusion. If we could be direct, explicit about what it is that we want to say, that would be appreciated. If you need more time to think, to figure out what would be the best way to articulate your thoughts, that is always acceptable. I have to do that myself at times. I will prompt about the metaphors. If we could just make an effort to be mindful about what we're saying, that is a major intent of this specific program. That said, if you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, commentary, that would be great. Make sure everybody has at least one opportunity to speak. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. just mix it so that we don't have to fight over a lot of unnecessary distortion. You can say whatever you need to, hit your mute mute button. And then if you have an additional question or thought, you can unmute and return to the line. Much obliged. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I almost forgot. I think last week I said I was supposed to, I said, lost all this weight. I'll remember this. I should share a tip each week, one tip for exercise and one tip for eating. Since I've had all this weight loss, that might be helpful for other victims. So tip for this week, I think having an eat window, very helpful. That was something that I started doing way back when the flood incident happened. So I guess at the beginning of the year. And when I say an eat window, that means that's metaphor. When I say eat window, you have a set time that you eat. And then once that time is done, there's no more eating. So trying to stop eating maybe at 10 p.m., maybe 9 p.m., picking a time in that frame where you stop eating so that you're not just eating all day long. And there was a report, I think this was when the cows was not broadcasting due to the flood. There was a report I heard where they said that people generally tended to be a little bit healthier, and they defined what they meant by healthier if they were not just eating, you know, whenever they wanted to, 12 o'clock at night, 3 o'clock at night, that sort of thing. If they had a specific set of hours, if it was a 10-hour set of 10 hours during the day that they would eat, or 12 hours, whatever it is. And the earlier that they stopped, it tended to be better. So that was one thing that I instituted that was healthier, not eating after 10 p.m. And then that's a food thing, an exercise thing. If you can, I was trying to reflect on, you know, I've been doing yoga daily for almost 10 months now. So things that keep you, I guess, inspired or motivated to continue, because I was reading something and they were talking about people that do like long term are able to stick with an exercise routine for like a year or more. They were saying that at some point, if you are doing this for weight loss or whatever, if you get to that level of fitness, it has to be something else to keep you continuing to do this beyond just, oh, I want to do this to lose weight. So with yoga, one of the things for this year, they've had lots of challenges at the studio. I think I mentioned the one where it was just supposed to do 30 challenges in a month. They've had lots of those throughout this year. One of them was to practice every day. One of them was taking a specific number of classes in a month. They're about to do another one at the studio next month. So lots of different ways where you get new sources of motivation that I know for me also helped having other Black people that I practiced with who were also eagerly enthusiastic about practicing because they would want to go and practice and go check this out. So I would share some of their enthusiasm. I think that could be helpful as well if you have somebody else that you are practicing with, or whatever your activity is, if it's swimming, hiking, running, whatever it is. If you have some other victims who can help keep you motivated, days where you might not necessarily want to go out and participate, but because, hey, we do this together, or we have done this together, let's go do this. That can be helpful as well. Those would be my tips for this week. So the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you have commentary to share, proceed. Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Greetings. Amber Geiger, 5'3", 110-pound white female officer, has shot a non-white person, non-black as well, 6 months prior to the shooting his brother and killing him. Which I find to be astonishing that she wasn't on. The other person that she shot, according to the article I read, is still recovering from his wounds, and she's back on the force. He, the other person, she said, grabbed for her taser. That's why she shot him at point blank range during a traffic stop. Lives on the third floor, but ends up on the fourth floor parking level. Witnesses say they saw her struggling to open the door, banging, yelling, and knocking. And his mother says he had a big bright red mat that she wore. That is, you know, would definitely be an indicator that you don't live there. You see that. Her story is that the door was ajar, however, and none of the banging and yelling and anything happened. No drug or urine test done on the scene, done a couple of days later. She was off duty, but the union and the Police Benevolent Society is giving her the full support as an on-duty officer. The family hired Benjamin Crump, who I always say that's a bad sign. You're not going to get any justice. That means you're just going to get paid. He's a civil lawyer, not a... They should be working with the district attorney in this instance. Now, Dallas PD, they shot pepper balls at a crowd of 100, only 100 people. And this was not at the command of the chief. She was very angry, and she happens to be a Black female, a person being classified as Black, but a female. So they went against her orders, and I thought shooting pepper balls thus was definitely a welding moment, Black balls. And I expect the deceased, Mr. Micah X. Johnson, to come up at some point during the trial if it goes that far, because, you know, they're going to say Dallas police have been under stress ever since, you know, Mr. X, they say, you know, I'm sure they're going to say shot those police officers. As for Serena, part of me never wanted to see her win again after she decided to date, marry, and be a child with this white non-suspect, a real racist. Just go to Reddit, his own website, and look at the commentary that and the content that's been put out there over the years, and you'll see exactly why I don't understand this. I hear a lot of people being classified as Black talk about her and give her a false narrative, totally take her out of context. And we read the book in the book club. She was not a little poor Black girl from Compton. Her father made the decision to raise her and her sister in Compton. And they went home to a very exclusive Los Angeles suburb during the weekends, where they went to the mall and shopped and did all those fun things. Mr. Williams owned one of the largest black-owned security companies in California before they were even born. He had money. If the tennis players, this other female, I forget her name, if she becomes a winner in the future, at least, like, unlike Mr. Woods, she has defined herself. So therefore, I don't expect her to be as well-endorsed because she has defined herself. Here in New York City, the NYPD trained all the school safety officers. You have to go through the same training as a police officer. I think if they go for 9 months, the safety officers go for six. It's just a cutoff, but it's definitely a training. During the Laquan McDonald segment, they said in the piece that they average a shooting a week in Chicago police. So that's about 52 shootings. According to killedbypolice.net, which I like because they post the article right next to each one of the killings that they put there. So you get to read, the actual article attached to it. There's only been 2 months out of this year so far that police haven't killed 100 people in that month. And that was the short month of February and the month of June. So 100 killings over 100 killings or 100 killings every other month. And they only went up to July. They didn't post all these numbers yet. Other than that, Gus, I'll mute my line. Thank you for the show.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary you would like to share, proceed. I am going to be interested if they bring up Micah Johnson's name during the shenanigans in Dallas. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Hi, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, caller from the 712. I want to know if that person that owns the Reddit that's married to Serena, I wonder, does he regulate the racist comments that go on there about her? Because she's a real target when it comes to white people when they say she's manly, and they're basically, stressing the fact that they're mad at her because she took over tennis or whatever. And I would be interested in finding that out. And I just wanted to comment really on all of the articles where, they should be listened to. And I want to comment on the taser with the children. They told you a child could go into a coma off of getting tased and has and all of these bad things. But did y'all notice the music that started off playing? It was like some type of hip-hop. Should I get up out of my seat and dance a little bit? Because we're about to get into this story about some children being tased at school and possibly could go up to losing their lives. I was disturbed by that music. I heard that report, too, because I listened to NPR. And when I first heard it, I was like, why do they have, what is going on? Why would they have music like that? Usually it's violins or some very, what they would say, somber music playing, like, something bad has happened because they'll get the music to match it. But this story, they went to the hip-hop chest and pulled out something it sounded like. So, I don't know. I was just disturbed by that. And so that's all I wanted to say. Thank you so much for taking my call and listening to me. And everybody have a safe week.
Much obliged. I do not. I normally try to crop out the music at the beginning, right? So I try to crop it out as much as I can, but I think that when they faded it, so it was still in the background, and I think you are completely correct that they had something really like snappy. I'm thinking of Invisible Man when different racists kept telling the main character, get hot. Like, they kept saying it at multiple, like, really inappropriate times. They're saying this. That one time where he's sick, talking about being passed out and unconscious. Anyway, but it was something like that. It was not somber, like you were saying, at all. I just, I can't remember exactly like the feel of what it was, because I do try to cut that out. But excellent point for the music piece on that segment. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Gus and guests. This is Draftomania. I am located in the storm in North Carolina, and I have been safe. I've just been in the house for the last couple of days during the storm. Thank God where I'm located at, it hasn't been, it really didn't hit us, you know, as bad as, you know, some of the other areas, especially near the water. I'm grateful for that. I'm glad to know we still have electricity and things like that, just some rain and some wind. And actually, I have to give thanks to you and your program for paying attention and taking this, bringing the attention to the seriousness as a result of listening to your programs. Now, I do now understand the seriousness of situations like these storms and how victims can become victimized even further during these storms. Another point I wanted to make, I swear, I know you're not really into the whole movie thing, but I got an opportunity to watch Black Klansman on one of the movie, you know, one of the internet station, internet channels, free internet. And I just wanted to say, like, it really affected me, the part, and I want to thank you again, Gus, and your program for waking me up, because I really didn't know how asleep I was, being brought up in the movement and all of that. Like, just as a result of listening to your program, it just catapulted my my consciousness to a whole nother level. So looking at this, when they were talking about, there was a part that was talking about, like, they was describing the lynching, and they was describing, like, you know how you talk about delectable Negro and how, you know, when how they just get a thrill out of terrorizing and killing us, and they were just, like, so they were so enthralled and so excited about the fact that they were going to kill some niggas. And I was like, wow. I thought back on to the Delectable Negro, and they had, what's his name? Harry Belafonte described the whole scene of how they took this man. And, you know, and it basically had me, like, I was depressed all day, kind of, like, just based on that, you know. And they described it, how they took this man. He was mentally retarded, and they took him, and they, like, they lynched him and cut his testicles off and took his body parts, and, you know, and all the people came out to watch. And it's just like, you know, like the type of. It's like, I'm really starting to be less confused about what we are dealing with, you know. And then I'm living here, you know, where I'm living at. And it's like, okay, another incident, like the thing that I would have not paid so much attention to, but now I'm paying attention to this, like, now I'm able to see it, what it is. And, like, you know, like, the being snuck up on, you know, where I'm living at, I'm living in a house with suspects. And, you know, like, that how we discussed on workplace racism and how they, like, creep up on you and scare you. And, you know, like, this shit has been, excuse my expression, been happening to me like a couple of times today. And, like, just being scared, it's like the tacky, trashy, terroristic tactics that they use. I'm just, you know, like being, you know, being aware of things. And not that I, like I said, I didn't know what the history was, but I'm seeing it from a whole nother view, from a counter-racist view. But And also me studying was also helping me to understand white supremacy, is researching and understanding, like narcissists, getting more understanding on the personality, narcissistic personality, psychopath personality, sociopath, reading up on those types of personality types. It helps you to also understand white supremacy. And like I said, guys, I want to thank you so much for your program. This is therapeutic, and like, this is my therapy, and like, I believe that you're saving my life, and thank you so much. That's all I have. Thanks.
Much obliged. Feel like I'm going to be called names soon, but much obliged. Hope it's worthy of your time and energy. If anything, I'm very glad to hear victims saying that, you know, they understand the seriousness of, you know, what's being done to us, the war being waged against us, and that's that's being reflected in their behavior. That is outstanding. If that's happening to victims of white supremacy who listen to the program, grand. Let's try to do more and share the information just to really take this seriously. Any sort of situations, the storm certainly, but our situation in general is one that should warrant a great sense of urgency. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Is that Mr. Steele?
Yes, this is Ken Steele. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, California. How are you doing today?
Right, poorly as always, especially poorly because summer ended so abruptly here in Seattle, it went immediately to late autumn. So especially right poorly.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The weather definitely seems to have turned rather quickly over here as well. So it's kind of nearing the end of short season, or shorts and polite society season, I guess. But I wanted to say to the listeners, there's a game that racist white supremacists, they enjoy playing with victims and amongst each other. And we ought not to participate in this game. The game is called Is This Racist? And racists will oftentimes bring up a situation that is blatantly racist, and they will open it for discussion amongst racists and victims of racism to debate if a certain situation is racist. The most recent incident that I was reminded of, or that reminded me of this phenomenon, was the Serena Williams racist cartoon that was released by, I believe it was a cartoonist named Ben Garrison, who depicted Serena Williams as some sort of ape-like individual, and then opponent depicted her as a white person, even though it was a Haitian that she was versing in this contest that was being lampooned in this cartoon. And various racists were asking the question, oh, is this racist? And one word that they like to use in relation to these discussions is learning. They like to say, oh, I like to learn all the different perspectives and all of the different takes on this situation. Oh, we need to learn what people think about this. Oh, we know there. I think that anytime you participate in that discussion as a victim of racism, you only validate this sort of this really sick game that they like to play. It was brought up to me, well, you know, I was invited into participating in one of these discussions. And I said, no, I'm not participating in this discussion at all. It's not worth having. And I said that only racists like to enjoy this sort of discussion. And it was brought up to me that, hey, some black people were also involved in this discussion. They gave their remarks. So I would encourage other victims not to participate in this conversation. Another variation of this conversation that is taking place right now, especially following the shooting incident, that the murder that happened in Dallas of the San Lucian national that was living there above a floor above a police officer. This incident, this variation is called "Is This Murder?" So racists will like to bring up situations that are quite blatant episodes of violence against Black people committed by racists and race soldiers. And they like to ask the question, is this murder? The first time that I remember this game being played was with the murder of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman. That was, in this game, they like to bring up every single minute detail of the incident, and they will debate to endlessly if, you know, this detail makes it murder, or this detail, or did he, you know, pull the gun? Did he, you know, was he crying for help? Yada, yada, yada. And all of those, all of these games, we need to have a response that is, I'm not playing that game. This is wrong. This is murder. We need to punish this person, period. And the only discussion that needs to be had by victims is how exactly are we going to exact any sort of mechanism to defend ourselves from these incidences from occurring, because they're not going to stop as long as the system of white supremacy exists. And debating it endlessly, all it does is give room for racists to justify their actions. So we need to stop being open to these sort of discussions. And we need to instead have discussions about what are we going to do to prevent this from happening again? What are we going to do to encourage, to discourage racists from attacking us like this? And that's the question that I encourage victims to ask. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I think the suspected race soldiers at the Young Turks, I think they do what you're talking about, the is this racist? I think they do that on a regular basis and as an exercise in them practicing racism. Other folks we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, everyone. You can please refer to me as Naeem. This would be my first time calling into the compensatory call-in. I've called in the past once for the workplace racism program, so I guess this would be a proper hello to everyone. Just forgive me as I put on my timer. 5 minutes is what I have, so I'll try to be quick about it. So I'm in respect to Pam, as opposed to simply listening, I would like to be able to participate in as many ways as I can to the cows. And so one of the things that has occurred within the past couple of days has been a consistent theme in terms of real life experiences for me, where I am witnessing interactions between non-whites that seem to forget or ignore the original source of the problem, which would be racism and white supremacy. So today I had two separate instances. They wrap around work, so I'm not sure if this would be classified as workplace racism. So I go to an internship, and so this happened on the week there, so I have to check in with you, Gus. Is that something that would not be permissible to speak about here on this program, or should I withhold?
Well, number one, workplace racism, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, every Thursday, neutralizing workplace racism. I don't think I have ever hushed anyone from talking about workplace racism and hope that that day never comes unless we have been successful in solving the problem. So certainly we are always welcome to hear about workplace racism.
I thank you for the floor. So this is what happened. So I'm based out in Brooklyn. And so for those who are in the New York area, I travel up to Crown Heights to grab what is called the Green Line. And so on my way there this morning, going up the hill, there was a confrontation that was happening between two drivers. One is a non-white, non-black, classified as Hispanic, brown male, speaking to a taxi driver who is classified as black. And so the conversation, as I heard it as I was walking up, was the Hispanic male, the brown male, saying to the black male, let's not do any of this fighting. And he was slamming his fist into his open palm. And so what he stated was, this is what the white man wants between you and I. I said, interesting. And so this led me to wonder, I wonder what my day would be like today. So that's the first part of my day in the morning. As I'm preparing to leave from my internship this evening, I work at a mental health clinic out in Long Island. We had a situation where a black male therapist had received a Hispanic brown male client who had his kid with him. Now, at the time, I did not know that this was what the person looked like, because where I'm seated and where I was working from, I did not have the visual, but I could hear everything that was going on. And so I heard the voice of a child speaking to the black male therapist, who I could see from my peripheral vision. And the conversation went as follows. So, hey, do you want to come into the room with me and with your dad? Because, you know, his dad's going in for his session. And the kid screams, no, I'm not going into this room with you. I'm scared of you. The black male goes, what do you mean you're scared? Am I a monster or something? Am I a big bad monster? At this point, I anticipated that there would be some sort of let's just say anti-black activity that would occur. And my suspicions were confirmed, because the child said, yeah, you big black gorilla. The black male then said, well, look, I'm not going to make any sounds, but okay. And proceeded to take the father in, who had a smile on his face. I wonder now about the supposed coalition that was being discussed earlier in the morning after I heard that. I thank you all for your time, and I will go ahead and mute my line.
Gorillas. Ignorant about racism. Thank you for calling in, Naeem. I guess you said this is your second time, so you're not technically a new caller, but newer. The first vignette, because you said at first, you said sometimes we victims lose sight of who is most to blame for our problems, racists. And the incident, I thought you said it was this car accident, and they were, I guess, talking afterwards, and the one victim said, let's not fight about this. That's what the white man wants us to do. That would seem like that they were, or at least one of the individuals was very mindful of, you know, who is to blame and who is orchestrating all of this. I thought it was, that sounds like, or at least one of them was trying to be constructive. Yes.
But this is where a situation where, it's more of a continuation of something that I experienced earlier, where there's always one who seems to be aware while the other is not. So I didn't clarify myself. I was concerned about time. So I sort of sped through the conversations. You know, this is also following into the last workplace racism episode, where one of the callers was talking about confusion and being able to understand whether or not it's a good time to parse out if somebody is less confused or more confused. And so that situation, like, there's always at least one person who seems to be less confused, while there might be one who's more confused. I hope that's a better clarification. Okay. If not, I apologize.
No apology needed. Yes, sir. That I got it. That frequently, at least my code, if you think you are less confused than anybody else present, then one of your main duties as an attempted counter-racist is to minimize conflict. If you say, hey, I think I'm less confused, that should be something that you take very seriously in how you're talking to and relating to other victims, especially relating to other Black people present.
But okay, thank you.
For sure, for sure. Gorillas, gorillas. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Greetings, can I be heard? Fire, please go ahead first.
Wonderful. Love it when folks can manage themselves.
Thank you, sir. Greetings, everyone. I'm going to be very, very, very short. Basically, what I'm reporting is kind of like a personal assessment of my counter-racist attempts this week. As far as I would say under the title of conversing dialogue is changing views, I get the opportunity from time to time, and primarily what I try to do is to not bring up racism, white supremacy. I give the opportunity for others to bring up the subject, which I'm finding out it's not very difficult for that to happen. I would say, especially in the times with the idea of so much attention that is on, let's say, examples like Mr. Trump, that I'm finding non-white people constantly are bringing up the subject as though the system of racism and white supremacy just started a year and a half ago. But nevertheless, it is an opportunity. I would say personally, there's been some improvement on my behalf on the discourse, that it doesn't break down into any arguing or anything like that. I have had several people to come up to me and basically state that in the discourse that I had with that other person or other people, that it was something that they got out of it that was constructive. And so that's basically where I kind of like get some of my grading from, and also with myself personally. I still can work on the idea of being, I would say in general, more courteous as a rule. When I'm in contact with other people. Other than that, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
V in New York, much obliged for yielding the speaking time.
Absolutely, no problem. Always willing to give my time to the elders. Peace to you, Gus. Peace to the retired fireman and to everybody who is on the line tonight. This is V from Central New York. How are you all doing? All right, so I have limited information to share, but three actual things. This was a very busy counter-racist week for me this week. So I'm going to have three very personal stories. The first bit of information I want to share is you mentioned the Young Turks, and I listened to their segment on Serena Williams, and what occurred, of course. And it was, it's amazing. I actually, for the first time in my life, and I am almost embarrassed to admit this, the idea that you have been saying for some time, Gus, that they are refined racists, really struck me by listening to this, because they didn't want to talk about racism. They wanted to talk about sexism. Now, of course, Serena Williams immediately, you know, she was brought up as the person who brought this up. So she made it about sexism. And of course, they were just commenting on it. But I compared their segment, which I would encourage everybody to please do, go and listen to what they said about Serena Williams, and then compare it with this black woman who actually played tennis named Paris Milan, M-I-L-A-N. She produced three very early videos on Serena Williams breaking down the match and explaining the idiocies in the calling and how it didn't make any actual sense how it actually happened. So again, her name is Paris Milan. Paris, like the city, P-A-R-I-S, Milan, M-I-L-A-N, and just compare the two. It is striking. Serena was the cause of the problem when the Young Turks was speaking, whereas the system was the problem, when Paris Milan was speaking. So that's the information that I wanted to share. And then the three very personal experiences. At the beginning of the week, there's a black male that I ride the bus with all the time. I see him constantly, consistently around the community. And him and I talk. And we don't talk about racism ever, really. I mean, periodically. He works in a very stressful job. He's, I think, the only black person that works that job. He makes a lot of money doing it. But from the stories he's told me, I can kind of surmise that he works around a lot of, well, okay, it's the reality. He works around a lot of racist people who say a lot of racist things to him, but they say it in just a manner where they couldn't be called racist. So he was off for a week, and I saw him his first day back, and him and I start talking, and out of the blue, he brings up the fact that the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, which I called in about a couple of years ago, is still very active underground in the community which we both live. And he actually knows two people, both of them women, who are active Klan members. He didn't explain why he told me this, but I suspect it's because we've attracted, as we kind of waited together to catch buses. We've noticed the police have been kind of swarming about. They've passed us a number of times. So maybe it was a warning on his behalf to me to be careful. Secondly, I was walking somewhere and I ran into, well, not ran into, that's a metaphor. But at a corner, I met this woman. We started talking about the weather and what the winter was going to be bringing. And when I presented the facts, the woman was definitely not white, but she seemed a little bit late to be considered black. So when I mentioned to her that the Old Farmers Government Act was calling for a really cold winter and how the last couple of summers have been decent, but the previous summer to that, I think I said 2016, was really, really warm, she disagreed, which I didn't mind. But then she actually approached two white people on the street as we were walking for confirmation that she was right. Both of those white people confirmed that she was right without questioning anything. And that was very telling to me. And then finally, again, walking around the community, as I often do, I saw two young black men talking. Actually, they came up behind me as I was walking, and they were talking, and it was kind of amazing because the one young man, I caught his eyes,
And I'm always dressed to impress, as my father said. You always make a mark. So I caught his eyes and he kind of smiled because I was wearing, you know, khakis and I was dressed. And they came behind me and they were talking about this salesman who obviously tried to rip them off, obviously. And the young man said, he goes, I didn't play it. The guy tried charging me $400. I told him that the going rate was $275 online, and I had just found it at this other store for $220. So if he was going to try to charge me $400, I was out of his store. Suddenly, the guy changed his tune and said, well, look, I can sell it to you for $250. I turned around to those two young men and said, absolutely. I go, the salesman was white, wasn't he? And they said, yup. And I go, you did exactly what you should have done. They will do that to you if you allow them to. And they smiled, and we had a moment, and then it was over. But in that moment, we confirmed what we both knew about racism. The point of those stories, every day, beyond the counter racist grind. Thank you, Gus, for the show. I will mute my line.
Much obliged. Context of white supremacy. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks that we missed completely, chime in. Out of the blue is a metaphor. I did want to. Out of the blue, definitely a metaphor. Other folks that we've not heard from.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am. Is this our female caller? Hello, now in South Carolina?
No, I live in Georgia.
Oh, whoops. Sorry. My apologies, ma'am.
I mean, nothing wrong with South Carolina. I have family there. I just don't live there.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's having the best evening they can have. I guess this is a medical apartheid experience. Not for me, thankfully, this time. My godmother got ill. She lives in Atlanta. She got ill. Her back, a major back event, spasm, I don't know, back event. So she goes to the emergency room. My back. I need pain, and I'm in pain. They wanted to send her. They sent her home. This was one Sunday. They said this was going on for like a month or so. So Sunday it happened. Monday they sent her home. She's like, I don't feel better. What are you doing? Something's wrong. No. We know. Whatever. So they sent her home. Of course, that same day. Oh my God, my back. What are you doing to me? I can't sit down. She has to go back to the emergency room. She's trying to tell them what's going on. They don't listen to her. They never, like, she doesn't know her body. Just, you know, go on and on and on. Finally, she tells them to take an MRI. They take the MRI. And they go, oh, yes, you're right. Ooh, flash, newsflash, I know my body. So, of course, the opiates are played throughout because she's in severe pain. The opiates are the thing that was opiate-type drugs. I keep saying opiates like she's a drug addict, which she's obviously not. But the opioid-type drugs will make her feel better. They don't want to give them to her. She's afraid she's going to get addicted. And, you know, she's like, look, I just help me with my back. So they finally do that. The black nurse, she says, finally does that. Of course, she feels better enough to go home, but then she's still in this extreme pain. My mother's telling me her tale of woe. I go, fine, I'll go with her to the doctor, only because of what? Medical apartheid book. So I go, we go through all these commotion, you know, she's explaining what's going on, this, that, another. And again, throughout this pain experience, it's like they don't want to give her the medication or the necessary things to make her feel better. And everything is revolving around this opioid. She doesn't know what she's talking about and all these things. Finally, she gets a shot. It only lasts a couple of days. She goes, she has to go someplace a little local. I can't go with her because I'm about an hour or so away. Again, she's telling them they don't want to give her a prescription for medication. She's like, look, I am in back pain. Like, this is severe. Please help me. Please help me. And so she has the shot. So then we, something happens. She calms down. She feels better a little bit. We go up Friday, and I'm expecting the second round of shots because this doctor, who is non-white but is not black, has told her, this may take 3 times. So I'm thinking, okay, the first time didn't take as well. She'll go get a shot this time. And the man tells her no. I'm like, why are these people not giving you shots? I'm like, did you at least get some medication in the event that this flare-up happens? She's like, no, they don't want to give me medication because they can see the activities that are happening. And so I told her, I said, the next time you go and they tell you something about this opioid thing, you tell her, you tell them, look, that is a white people problem. I am in pain. Help me. So hopefully she will feel better, but just her, the things she had to go through to get the proper medications and the treatment, of course, and she is an African-American or classified as a black person. Thank you.
Medical apartheid, top 5 books. We've discussed that issue in terms of white or racist doctors, healthcare practitioners, terrorizing black patients. And I thought it was important when you were saying with the scheduling of the appointments where you couldn't be there to assist. That's one of the things we've suggested for a long time. If you can have someone who is healthy, who can be there to advocate, you know, to ask those types of questions or to just say exactly what you just said, all that nonsense about opioids that is white. And then you can add the addendum. And the same research has shown that consistently whites do not give black people the same access to pain medication. I think that's talked about in medical apartheid. Dorothy Roberts talked about that. She's been on the program repeatedly. I would hit them with that too, and might even have that article handy if you know you got to go to the hospital. I think that might be a metaphor. I would have that article on your phone, or you can pull it up. You know, forgot what year it is. My apologies. I'm behaving like a Neanderthal. Excuse me. You can just pull it up on your phone. That data is right there. You can pick out if it's a, because it's been in so many different outlets. You can use an NPR report where they're talking about this and just show them that this is, you know, a routine problem where black people don't get access to pain medication. Let's make sure that that's not happening here. And then go back.
Yeah,
to,
and like I said, the only reason I went, because I love her. But you know, sometimes you have issues. But if it wasn't for that book and knowing the treatment she may receive, that's the only reason I went anyway. Because, like I said, because of that book and knowing what could happen.
Mm. Harriet A. Washington, top 5 on my top 5 book list. Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid. In the archives, you can go back and listen, very important book study session. Other folks, much of I hope everything goes really well. Speedy recovery. Sorry you had to, you and your family had to endure that. Health is really important and easily compromised in the system of.
Oh, and also, I just want to say they recommended physical therapy. I'm like, well, they didn't give you a schedule. He's like, no, just keep losing weight, physical therapy, and yoga. But no plan. And this was at a point at pain center where you can look back and see all the weight machines and all the things they use for therapy. I was like, okay. Okay.
Wow. Consistent in with regards to just the ways that whites practice racism, where you just don't get the same quality of care. Vernelia Randall talked about that. She's been a guest, talked about this exact same subject in her book, Dying While Black, where she talked about even with some of her own relatives. It just happens she does research on this, but this was happening to her family as well, where you just get really sloppy, incompetent care, where they don't even give you any detail. Oh, yeah, just do, you know, a few push-ups. You'll be good. Yeah. All right. Medical apartheid. Much obliged for sharing, and again, I hope speedy recovery. Speedy Thank recovery. You. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Folks spectating or?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to us, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with, there was another term that I was thinking of that could be also a word to look out for. And it was used in a metaphor called like flesh out. When someone, I don't know if anybody's ever heard someone say, waiting for things to flesh out, I think. And I looked up the definition on a, I think it was on Word. It's like where you type up documents and it'll show you a definition. And I think, well, actually I did read that. It said it was white skin. And I think it had fair is a definition for it. And I know there's a crayon actually that is the same pigment as white, I guess, a pale complexion. So that was another one I wanted to add in. And as far as the segments, that one segment where they were talking about the taser being utilized in the schools, it was interesting how she, and I noticed this on two of the segments, she was saying, well, you know, I can't say why this is happening. I can't say why it's why this is happening. And there is really no research to back up, but things are just showing that black children seems to have this happen to them the most. But she seemed to have background data on, I guess, suspensions, I think, and I guess students who have been punished or whatever, but they didn't have any information on any time these weapons are utilized. So I don't know. I think she may have been dishonest or practicing racism on that. And I think it was also another segment where maybe they were talking about loans being given out to non-white people, I guess, dealing with homes and house ownership. And that was another response. Person said, hey, well, I don't know. I can't tell you why this is happening. I cannot tell you why. But you're talking about people, these things happening to black people, but you can't tell me why is this happening. Like things like that, I think that is shown in the segments, they know obviously why it's happening, racism, white supremacy, but they just won't basically just say that and be more direct. And there was a commercial that I had saw. It was for a product, I think it's for eczema, a skin condition. And what I noticed was that the way they introduce, I guess, the people who are the child actors in the commercial, it was a little girl. I guess she may have been like Asian or something like that, non-white, and she was blowing out the candles. And the person, the narrating lady, was saying the Eucrisa can work for the skin condition, eczema, for, I guess, the face of a birthday girl, the arm of an artist, it flipped, you know, it turned to a cut to a white child. It looks like that was painting a picture. And then it went to a black child and he was pulling on a rope. And just my, like, when I saw that, I thought that was like racist imagery. I don't know if anybody has ever seen that commercial. I don't know if you may have seen it, Gus, but I just wanted to share a report on that just briefly. And that's all I have right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
I have not seen that commercial, but I will check on it. And that is consistent, the observation about why these things keep happening to Black people. And that report, I think that was from earlier this, or not summer anymore, this past summer, they were talking about all the Negroes are homeless in Seattle. We've been studying this for 5 years, and we just can't seem to figure out what the issue is. Consistent. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up that we've missed completely. If you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings. My name is DJ. I'm from the Connecticut area. I am enrolled in a accelerated route to certification program, and I was called a racist today by an older white woman. We were shown a film in class in which this lady gets off the train in Grand Central, and she misses her next train, so she has to eat at a lunch counter. The film is in black and white, and she gets a salad from the lunch counter, and it's a white guy behind the counter, and she asks the guy, how much is the salad? He goes, $3. She goes that she doesn't have enough. He gives her the salad anyway. She goes to sit down at a table, and she realizes that she doesn't have a fork, so she goes to retrieve a fork. When she goes back to the table, she sees a black gentleman who's dressed like a bum eating her salad. She goes to yell at him, but instead of yelling, decides to sit down, and she stares at him, takes her fork, starts eating the salad with him, and he yells, he makes a noise. Then the guy gets up, he goes to get some coffee, comes back to the table, sits the coffee down on the table. The lady drinks the coffee, and then the guy gets up and leaves. The lady looks over and realizes that her bags that she had brought is not next to her, and she automatically assumes that the guy has taken her bag, so she gets up to go and run off for help to look for the guy who's taking her bag. When she goes to, she never finds the guy. She goes back to the restaurant and realizes that she, in the first place, she set the salad down, the salad that she originally got, at the wrong table, and she just ended up eating a random guy salad. I forgot to discuss it, but earlier in the film, like when she first gets off the train, she runs into a black guy. The black guy accidentally hits her. Her bags fall out her hand, and she gets really upset. So as the film ends, the teacher wants our responses, and I was like, well, they're not so nice to the black people in the film. And me and this other gentleman, mind you, I'm the only black guy out of 80 people in this program. And the gentleman I'm talking to, he basically agrees how they're not so nice to the black people. And this other lady decides to enter our discussion, and she just calls me, she implies that I am a racist in a tricky way. And then later on,
what did she say? Like, do you remember, like, as best you can, like the specific wording she used?
She said, "Back in my day, people would say that you are a racist," and I was. She said something about her being raised in the past or something. Now, so the class goes on. Now, the teacher is giving a lecture, and she goes, "A thing about a good teacher is that you have to challenge the status quo." So I raise my hand and I go, well, as a black man, I cannot, I feel like, and a new teacher, I cannot challenge the status quo because I'll be out of there. They'll fire me. And it was a big deal about that. And I just feel so out of place in this program. And, like, I was really, really, really upset, but I had to basically laugh it off. And I just have white people in my face all the time. They want to get to know me, and I have no desire to get to know them because they're aggravating. But thank you for allowing me to share.
Sounds like workplace racism. Yeah, workplace racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You wanted to share, which is totally acceptable. I guess my thought, counter-racist suggestion to be rejected or thought about, you know, if it's of any value. I think number one, for those types of programs, I think having accurate expectations going in, it can be frustrating for all of us. Dr. Welsing talked about this. Dr. Umar talked about this when he was getting his finishing his doctorate, that it can be very frustrating. I think understanding when you begin these programs, or if it's a job situation, all of them are going to be anti-Black. None of these environments are created for our success, for us to do well. They're not set up, you know, in that way at all. And understanding the different ways that racism is going to be practiced in these environments against us, whether that's grading or promotions, depending on, you know, what the setting is, or whites just being really invasive and asking you a lot of questions, and we want to study you and find out as much as we can. We talk about that all the time. Thursdays, workplace racism, just expecting that and then having a code. I already understand this is what it's going to be like, and this is how I'm going to function to neutralize, you know, and even to neutralize the impacts so that I'm not in that position of having to laugh things off. Man, I think a good number of Cal's listeners, a white person, especially a white person in a work environment, even sound as if you're saying that I am a racist. Oh, boy, a great time to practice my counter-racism. Ma'am, what is your definition of a racist? How would I be considered a racist, a Black male? And explain, please, in what time period, where, how? Questions, especially once you're in an environment where it seems like you can talk about that. And even, you know, to that said, I'm not sure if once you have correct expectations about what it means to be white in that sort of environment, I am not sure that it's always the most constructive thing to say, well, I can't, you know, challenge the status quo because I will be fired as a Black male. They know this. They're not ignorant. You're not at least I've taken the position, you're not telling them anything that they don't know. So sometimes it might be best to not say anything. And that's Dr. Umar. I'm paraphrasing. This is 2011. He talked about this specifically, and he said he used to do exactly what you're talking about, ask questions and point out racism and how it impacts him and what have you. And he said that just made it more difficult for him to complete his program. He said if he were to reflect back on things he would change, he said he would do less of that. You can do that once you have that degree, that you can just get your degree or whatever it is that you're, just complete the program, and then you can pinpoint the racism, white supremacy. But you're not telling them anything that they're unaware of, that you being able to quote unquote challenge the status quo will have you terminated as a Black male. They know that. They'll be the ones, or them or their husbands or nephews or cousins or whatever it is, neighbors, they'll be the ones that terminate you. They'll be telling racist jokes about you, the Black and Decker Pecker wrecker and the other niggers that we terminated on the job today. Other folks that we missed completely have a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, I'm Mhandisi.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you. Greetings to the host, callers, and listeners. I wanted to ask, was it Mr. Malema who said that white people are inflicting genocide on the Black people, the Black Americans here in America, and that they're inflicting genocide on the Black people in South Africa? Was it Mr. Malema?
You're speaking about Julius Malema, Black male in that part of the world, the area of the world known as South Africa. I couldn't, if someone challenged me, like to pull up a specific speech where he said that or a quote, it might take me a moment from what I know of his politics and views. That seems very reasonable, but if someone, you know, challenged me, they wanted an exact date, it would take me, I would have to go do some researching.
Well, I'll send you the video that I saw.
Oh, okay. I thought it sounded like you were asking a question. If you,
I was, but I didn't know if it was, if that's the person, but I have to, check the video again. This guy, I believe Mr. Malema said this. So I would say, yes, Mr. Malema, we are experiencing genocide here in America. White people are inflicting genocide against us here in America. And I know they're inflicting genocide on the black South Africans in South Africa. And we both know, and we all know, that white people are inflicting genocide on all the people, all the black people all over the world. And so we have to stop that. And as an indigenous person here in America, an indigenous person of America, and also an indigenous person of Africa, my blood has been mixed. I want to extend a alliance. I want us to have an alliance, South Africa and America, and build the alliance with the rest of Africa, the rest of the black people, and stop white supremacy. Thank you.
Much obliged, M. Hondisi. Other folks, we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Did we nab everybody? Anybody with a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Spectacular. We got everybody. Any other folks who had additional questions, comments that they wanted to add? If any other folks wanted to respond. The caller that we heard from sounded like he was having a difficult time with his academic program, with the whites inquiring, trying to learn, study as much about him as they can, and then him questioning how he is not able to challenge the status quo. Any thoughts on what he had to share or anything else that's been covered on the broadcast this evening?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hi, this is Naeem again. So I have been through a similar situation where I went to a predominantly white college. And one of the things that was difficult was that you'll constantly be exposed to and bear witness to a number of atrocities that will be inflicted on you and to others around you who are classified as non-white, especially those who are classified as black. The part where it gets difficult is, as you mentioned, Dr. Umar Johnson stating that, you know, you probably want to do less of the particular pointing out and then wait until afterwards. But depending on what you're trying to do, you'll actually still need to have a reasonable relationship with the, at that point, alma mater. So it is a very difficult position to be able to, yes, understand and point out the racism that you're experiencing, but it's almost like, well, if you do that, not only will you have a harder time getting this degree, but when you do get this degree or whatever a certification or piece of paper that you need to get from them, there won't be the full backing of the program that you're at. So it's almost like you have to find a person within the school. Hopefully it's not a white person, but at least one. I think I've heard this before in workplace racism. You at least want to have one white person at the very least that you have some measure of rapport with that would be able to assist you in whatever particular activities that you can get information from, I believe is how it was termed. So this is going to be an ongoing situation for the gentleman who called in. about that. Expect that to be the case. Expect that they will continue to bother you, even when you don't mention anything. Your presence alone is cause for concern alone, especially that you're the only one. Now they're like, okay, how did you get in here? Why are you here? Are we trying to have some sort of charity case by bringing you in here? There are a multitude of things that are running through their minds, and they will let you know quite clearly how they feel about you. So utilize the catalyst here as your source of support, information, knowledge, to the best of your ability. I most certainly have, even though I have not given back in the manner I need to. But definitely, you know, utilize this resource that you have it here. Thank you.
Much obliged, Naeem. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, questions, suggestions, proceed. The person who dialed in, I'm trying to make sure I get people. I thought there, it seemed like there were people who had not participated. The caller at 1-838, Tenny B, if you had commentary.
Hey, Gus and all the callers. It's been a long time. I don't want to, I want to let you know that I didn't intend to be a lurker. I just have had so much going on and wanting to get my words right before speaking, but I do follow you all in the archives and appreciate what everybody has to say. And Gus, I sure do appreciate you very much. And I'll show you that in PayPal real soon. And I'm just tuning in late, and that's pretty much the races here in Tennessee are coming hard at me, but I'm trying to hold on, and it's pretty overwhelming at times. It's pretty and I think that they are really wound up over their president and vice president being impeached and expelled from the White House, with what Manafort knows, and they down here, which is a so-called red state and Confederate state, and they're still reacting the Civil War, but they're angst about what's going on with the president has really got them coming hard. And I wonder if they're really losing footing, and there's something called the blue wave, this follow back resistance. And the concept is that it doesn't matter, just vote Democratic. It'll all get sorted out later. But just vote blue, the blue wave. And I've been thinking about this whole concept of the blue wave, and it's just the same side, a different side of the same coin, and wanting to use, black people to get what white people want. And I just wondered if anybody else, and I didn't get to hear the show earlier, the program earlier. Did you talk about this at all?
We did not talk about that today, none of the clips talked about that, and none of the callers thus far had brought that up. Although I can certainly see that racists using that, like, yes, Donald Trump is a racist, just him. We whites who are not racist don't want him to be there anymore, and you should come vote with us, because they might even do what the Young Turks are doing now. They're saying progressive. That's it. We're progressive. Come and vote with us, and we'll make things all better, and we will get rid of that no good racist Trump, and then there'll be no more racism. Like, I certainly could see that, and particularly the way that they're using some of the black candidates in some of the states, Florida, Mr. Gillum, he's a victim of racism. Just saying, I think that could be an aspect of the, yes, we're not racist and come, we will fight this thing out together. Well, I won't say, we will get rid of Trump together, get rid of the racist.
Yeah, and even locally, for instance, in New York, they are with the white female named Cynthia Nixon. She lost. She's a homosexual. And she lost her bid for governor. And they are already, the white women, the ones who wear the pink hats on their heads, are blaming black women for not coming out to vote, that she would have won if black women had come out to vote.
Blame the Negros. Same thing that they did back in 2016. We would have had Hillary Clinton if the Negros had come out to vote.
Mm-hmm.
52% of white women got Donald Trump in, so I'm sure a substantial number of white women probably did not support their sister, Miss Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was, I guess I had a counter racist strategy, which was with all of this blue wave and the concept of just vote blue. Well, then maybe it's time to just sign up to run for an office across the nation and for counter race to just get in there and just say what needs to be said and get those this blue wave right into the offices. And then, you know, print up some hats afterwards, you know, like the cows.
I think some listeners are attempting to do that in various ways. We did just talk about that. They can perhaps see if we have time left in the broadcast, but I think some folks are trying to implement that very strategy, Tenny B. Give
Is that
me,
right?
Yes, ma'am. Give me one moment. I just wanted to nab some of the other folks that we have not heard from at all. Let's see. I think Jay in St. Louis. You had a hand up, sir. Did you have commentary?
Yeah. I wanted to just speak about the police, in Tennessee, that area, and the fact that they, you know, how anti-blackness, how they consume it and how it feeds everything they do as the soldiers of this tyrannical government. That's no metaphor, tyrannical indeed. I also wanted to say I had a similar and I have similar experiences in an academic environment, not being taken seriously as a black male. My advice would be also to find preferably a non-white scholar that is willing to talk to you. Best case scenario in the same field of study, so you're able to see how they articulate the boundaries. I think that can help a lot in really just being prepared for it and just realizing that it's going to happen, that you're not going to be taken seriously. They are going to act like you're violent and angry, and they are going to simplify you, and, you know, so what? It's just a part of it. And yeah, that's all I really had to offer with that. But I actually, speaking to the last caller, now I just remembered the ways that going through your graduate school education and kind of putting your interest in studying true justice for this society can really impact what you're able to do long term. I had the chance to speak with a non-white academician just yesterday, and the amount of confusion and even hostile responses to trying to eliminate some of that confusion in the academy can be really sobering and off-putting. to see how, you know, even maybe 20, 30 years out of graduate school, certain victims are still perpetuating certain types of discourses and narratives for the incentive system that whites implement within that institution. So I would just say, you know, be proud that you disengage from that incentive system, and just, you know, let the chips fall where they may. That's all I have to say.
Chips fall where they may is for sure. No apologies needed. All victims, still, well, at least the folks here, victims still learning. Other folks, Ivy, did you have a commentary? You should be with us, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus. Thank you. And greetings to all the callers on the line. So the man who spoke up about when he said, you know, the white people weren't nice to the black people, I just wanted to say that that was a great comment. And I think that the effectiveness of it was proven by the hostile response from the racists. So I just think that was incredible, personally. I'll say another resource where the archives are is at archive.org, the Cal's archives. And the exact link is archive.org/details/the Cal's radio show. And then the other one is the same thing, archive.org/details/the Cal's radio show 2. And so that's a lot of the archives from, I want to say, from the beginning, from like 2009 to like 2012. And there's a just I think there's just a lot of archives there that you don't see in other places. So that's a great resource in my opinion. The woman who spoke up earlier, is her name Minnie B or Tinny B, or neither one?
Both. Minnie B, formerly Minnie B, now Tinny B.
Okay. Well, Miss Tinny B, it's great to hear from you, and should we do to you? And you know, I just listened to you've been like on the couch for like so long, and I listened to a broadcast just this week with you on there, and your commentary was very constructive. And I just wanted to ask real quick, I asked this question already, and one person answered it because it just wasn't a lot of time. For anyone who would like to answer this question, including you, Gus, what do you think that we need to solve this problem? What is it that we're lacking? And I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. If there are folks who have not shared, who think they have a comment, question they need to get in before we wrap up, please get your hand up now. We have less than 15 minutes remaining, so if you think you have something you need to say, go ahead and raise a hand. The number 641-715-3640 and the code 564-943, pound, press star 61 if you would like to participate. Ivy did remind me, yes, we can hear you. Just give me 1 second. At this point, we probably need several archivists for the cows. I did not think there would come a day when there would be almost 2,000 episodes, but that day is rapidly approaching. So, and I've just been thinking of this with Pam the Great passing. I don't know how many programs she has done on the cows. It would be easier to get that number. Well, somewhat easy. It would still be a challenge, but it would be somewhat easier if we had archivists and could get that done. I was thinking just for posterity's sake, certainly Gus T is going to expire at some point, so it might be constructive towards getting this problem solved to have the cows all archived and saved, just because we do have a lot of records of Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, Pam the Great, quite a few folks, even Timothy Wise. So it would probably be a good idea to get that preserved. So if folks are willing to be archivists and get all 2,000 saved, that would be grand. Would probably be good to have several folks who have the full volume so that that can be stored correctly chronologically. If we have volunteers who would be interested, you can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I'll probably have to ask about that seriously because, yes, it would be very good to have several of those. The caller who just spoke up, thank you for your patience, sir.
Yeah, this is Ken Steele from Los Angeles. I wanted to answer the question that I believe Ivy posed. I think she was the last caller, correct?
Yes, sir.
The question as to what we're lacking. And from what I can tell, from just observing, I think that amongst victims of racism, we lack a willingness or a desire to physically combat vicious racist white supremacists, and this seems to be a pattern that I'm observing, not just here in the United States, but even in places where victims of white supremacy far outnumber white supremacists. I think that there is just a lack of willingness to fight, die, and kill racists in order to remedy this situation. And until a critical mass of us come to that conclusion and come to the willingness to engage racists in that manner, I don't think that we will find any sort of relief or any sort of peace from within the system or without the system. So I think it's just that willingness to fight them. I think that is one thing that we're lacking for sure.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to answer or respond to Isis's question, and I agree with Ken. I think that being willing to fight by, you know, using our best thinking and being willing to fight and learn how to fight. That's number one. Learn how to fight. And some, you know, actual tactical strategies would be good because they aren't afraid of us as a people, and they aren't threatened by us. Really, it's all that goes with the 911. They're calling 911 not because they're afraid; it's because they get a response. But the other thing is I think we're in isolation, and I think something that would be of great assistance is some compounds across the country to network and come up with alternative, you know, come up and really use code language, because they're gonna cut down the internet. And the fact that the president is going to be texting all of us next week is going to let us know just if their system is working to control and interrupt our phones when they need to. And I think having an alternative way of communicating back to the Underground Railroad and linking up with other resistors would be important.
For sure. Let's see. Red in Vegas, did you have commentary?
Hello, thank you for allowing me to share. So the only thing I wanted to mention because of the whole fighting thing, is, or like, well, not fighting thing, but victims should be better prepared, especially with all the different militias that racists have. all throughout the country, but they don't necessarily call it as such. It's like tactical training. But the one thing I did want to mention, I was watching the news recently, and in Las Vegas, they own the worst white-on-white crime, domestic terrorist event that has ever happened in history, but they don't call it as such. They only say October 1 or October 1st, but they won't actually, most of the time they won't even say the October 1st shooting. That's something that I noticed. But anyways, they're still processing Stephen Paddock, who is the domestic terrorist who is not labeled as such. They're still processing all of his assets, and they said that he had $63,000 worth of guns and ammunition. So if we definitely need to just keep that in mind, I definitely agree with being having some type of plan as far as being able to counter the racism that we receive in any way. But maybe we definitely need to definitely start as soon as possible. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I think what Red said that was quite compelling is they don't call it, they're not giving it a terrorist or a thing. Like, I even think if the people who are today called white, but back in the time of this event, they were called Italian Americans, if they were called white at the time of the St. Valentine's Day massacre, that wouldn't even have that name. It wouldn't be called the St. Valentine's Day Massacre today. There's also a play on the fact that they were Catholics. When you look at war and the synonyms of war, and you look at the synonyms of race, you're pretty much looking at the same thing. Conflict is used in both. Struggle is used in both. Contest, contention is used in both definitions. Event, match, is used in both. Engagement is used in both. So you're talking about the same thing. Racism is war. And we all have to realize that as the number one thing to get solve the problem is have the mindset that this whole thing is a war against us. Some of us don't think that way. And as soon as we all think that way, I think that this problem will be solved rather quickly. Republicans and Democrats, all racists in Congress, like the police force, like prison guards, like banks, I don't see other white people calling out the racists. So I have to assume they're all racists because we see the policies and things, and you have to imagine the backdoor discussions. And I don't see... I mean, in fact, I saw a racist like John McCain who voted against Martin Luther King holiday, if you be reminded, he was just praised, and we know he's a racist. I mean, he didn't see any country he didn't want to bomb, and all non-white people, and he was equal opportunity, bomb Russia, I mean, everyone. But what you have between Republicans and the Democrats is refined racists versus less refined racists. That's all. Either way, they're racist. And if a white person called me a racist, you know, I think I agree with Gus. It's time to get in the question lane. And I invoke my VGQ privileges. But if I had to choose between giving everyone justice, including white people, and having the ability to actually really practice racism against white people, I think I would try to get some retribution. I mute myself. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Much of a lot. Yes, sir, Thomas. I mean, retired firefighter. I just wanted to say really quick, I don't think we will need every single non-white person, because I think the word all was used. I don't think we will need all of the non-white people to get an understanding of racism, white supremacy, or what it means to be white. I just think we need a critical mass. Retired firefighter, 30 seconds.
Agreed. Deception is the number one weapon that is used by our enemy, and the effect that it has on victims of racist white supremacy is confusion. The action the activity that we carry out with our confusion is one of them is we lack focus. We lack focus. Our focus is very easily deferred to things that are not constructive. We can be starting off talking about racism, and before you know it, we'll be arguing and fussing and accusing another non-white person as being Uncle Tom or something of that nature, and totally take the focus off of our enemies, who actually are the powerful soldiers against us, you know, in the system of racist white supremacy. So that's one aspect of to Ivy's question as far as what we have a problem with. Also, what I find out that we're going to have to have in our understanding that it's logical to think that the global system of racism, white supremacy can be countered. Most, overwhelmingly, unfortunately, most non-white people don't think that that is a reality. And it's actually a logical thought that anything that's put together could be taken apart. And once those two things are accomplished, then the system of racism, white supremacy is towards its end. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. That will conclude the broadcast. Again, the book club will be here Friday, fourth installment, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thursday, Neutralizing Workplace Racism. You can check Black Talk Radio Network as well as the Facebook page for updates for the next broadcast. You can always drop an email if you have gripes, complaints, guest suggestions. Drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Hope it was a constructive investment of everyone's Saturday evening. I will say again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Race soldiers, they have done a lot of damage to non-white people, black people specifically, where we were just not able to think correctly and make quality decisions because we've been impaired with white's toxins, narcotics. I think Dr. Welsing and many of the folks that we esteem would strongly encourage us, let's be sober, take care of our health so that we can solve this problem permanently, promptly. In addition to being sober, if you're out and about the last few hours of summer, for people that are in an environment that lucky, have fun, be sober, and be buckled up. If you are out in a vehicle, driver or passenger, you want to be buckled up every single time you are in a vehicle. Let's do all we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. They mentioned in that segment about off-duty officers, a number of them being under the influence. We have talked about that on this program for years. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people. With other black people, we ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.